Can legislators take your seats, please? Our first item of business tonight is a public hearing on the Tompkins-Cortland Community College operating budget for 2010-2011. Is there anyone who'd like to speak to us about that budget? Hearing no one, the meeting of the July 6th meeting of the legislature, the Tompkins County Legislature, is called to order. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
And to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, and indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Roll call members, please.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Here.
Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Chalk?
I'm here.
Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Ms. Herrera?
Here.
Ms. Kiefer?
Present.
Mr. Lane?
Here.
Ms. McAsey?
Here.
Mrs. McBean-Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna?
Here.
Mr. Proto?
Here.
Ms. Pryor?
Here.
Mr. Robinson?
Here.
Ms. Robertson?
Here.
15 members present.
Thank you. Present, proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
I would like to ask for an executive session at the end of this meeting to discuss a personnel matter and real estate negotiations. Are there members of the public who'd like to address the legislature? Do we have anyone signed up?
Okay. Yes.
David Skowronek, please, first, and then Dami Harris.
Hi. Hello. My name is David Skowronek. I'm the executive director of the Drop-In Children's Center. First of all, I want to thank you once again for your consideration of the Drop-In Center's request for funding. Your help over the years has been critical to our efforts to serve the child care needs of our community. For those of you who don't know us, the Drop-In Center has been providing child care to residents of Tompkins County for over 30 years. While open to everyone, we focus our efforts on serving low and moderate income families. The vast majority of our clients, currently over 90%, receive daycare assistance from the Department of Social Services, Tompkins County Department of Social Services. Most of the remainder of our clients qualify for our sliding scale reduced rates. The money we receive from both of these sources is actually well below our cost of care. So the funding that you help us with goes directly to making up that difference. As I just mentioned, the trend for our center has now moved to serving almost exclusively families who receive child care assistance from DSS. As a result, many of the children that now attend our center come from homes that are challenged by the difficult conditions often associated with low income and poverty. Among these is the exposure to violence and abuse that is expressed either directly toward them or toward other members in their household. This often leads to aggressive or violent behaviors exhibited by the children themselves and can present a severe impediment to a child's ability to learn and get along with other children. Because of these factors, we have decided to shift the emphasis of our program to one that focuses on the social and emotional development of each child. One method we use, called Second Step, which is also used by the Ithaca City School District, has proven to be very effective in helping our children manage their strong emotions and the negative behaviors that accompany them. It also helps them develop empathy for the feelings of their classmates and better understand the consequences of their aggressive actions on others.
One more minute.
It helps us teach them to give the alternatives to the biting, hitting, and spitting and cursing that often result. We also do a very detailed behavior plan for each child that records their actions over many weeks. And that allows us to work with their parents as well, who we consider partners in our efforts to modify the child's behavior. It also ensures that the child gets the same sort of encouragement and support with the same words used both at home and at the center. Finally, it provides a set of tools to the parents who often feel helpless when their child is suffering and acting out. So this shift in emphasis has really made a difference. Our goal is really to prepare these children so that when they enter public school, they will be ready to learn and ready to socialize with the other children. So once again, your help is critical to us moving forward, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Dami Harris, please.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity, and thank you for all your support and the funding in the past. I am here actually not to share good news, but I want to share, I think I owe it to you all to let know what is going on. My center, some of you all know, but some of you probably don't know the programs. We had a welfare to work program, which we call it Bridge Program, which was a $327,000 program.
Excuse me, Dami.
10 years.
Excuse me, Dami. Some of our new legislators might not know you're with the director of the Women's Opportunity Center.
I'm sorry. I'm the executive director of the Women's Opportunity Center and has been for the past 22 years. So the Bridge Program actually was completely eliminated this year by the governor. And that program had helped women referred by the DSS who had never worked before, who is coming from generational poverty. So I have 6 staff members who went through with them in detail, not only the resume, but work skills and everything that they have. They come with so many barriers, and we have scholarship funds, partly sponsored by, supported by the county funding, and remove the barriers. And for example, a woman last week got a job at Wegmans and couldn't go to work because she has sneakers, but she doesn't have the bottom of the sneakers, is nothing there. So we were able to buy a pair of sneakers. We do little things sometimes and make a big difference. So that program is completely eliminated, and the displaced homemaker program we had over the past 30 years, and we help over 12,000 women from that program. And that program is actually in the middle of the war. The assembly and senators want to fund us, but the governor keeps vetoing it. So I don't know. Currently we have 1 million, which is used to be 7 million program for 22 centers. So currently we have 1.5 TANF funding for the program, and the other stuff we don't know yet. So we served over 12,000 people, and we had about 4,500 women got jobs through our program. We put more than 60 million back to the community just by calculating the wages, not looking at the savings from the welfare, or we prevent women going into welfare by getting them jobs before they get into that status. So we have to let go of definitely 6 staff I have to let go. And there will be minimum, probably maximum 2 staff at the center. So they keep saying that they're going to make us whole next year or year after. So I don't know. But if any one of you all have any brain power that you can use and give it to me, I'll take any advice how to run the program. So I appreciate and keep looking for that hidden money somewhere, and so we all can share. Thank you. I won't take much time, but
thank you very much, Dami.
And I pass some information so you all can do bedtime reading. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Tomo Shibata.
Hello, my name is Thomas Shibata. I'm trying to establish a community project and organize stalking, and this is what I'm going to talk about. According to the special report titled Stalking Victimization in the United States, issued by the Bureau of Justice Statistics in the Department of Justice in 2009, an estimated 3 million persons aged 18 or older were victims of stalking in the United States during a 12-month period. Stalking is defined in this report, as well as in federal and state criminal laws, as a course of conduct directed at a specific person that would cause a reasonable person to feel fear. 6.5% of the stalking victims in this survey responded that the number of stalking offenders is unknown, while 13.1% responded that the number of offenders is 3 or more. The stalking of one individual by a number of perpetrators large enough to prevent the target from identifying the number is characteristically called organized stalking, cause stalking, gang stalking, and so forth. Thus, according to this survey, an estimated 221,000 individuals in the United States were subjected to organized stalking, during the 12-month period. According to private investigator David Lawson, who conducted private investigation for organized stalking victims for 12 years by joining stalking groups and wrote a book titled Cold Stalking. According to this book, the target is stalked by groups of people, each group consisting hundreds of people. The stalking group members are taught that the target is the reason for their problems. Leaders hope that the group will want to resolve their problem. The scapegoat rhetoric can result in assault and murder, especially if the target is female or old.
One more minute, please.
Okay, those who have opportunity to spy on and assault the target's neighbor and so forth, are often told maliciously post gossip about the target and bribed with cash or illegal drugs into carrying out the mission. According to Lawson and Derek Robinson, the president of the NPO called the Freedom from Covert Harassment and Surveillance, who have interacted over 100 targeted individuals in the last 5 years, the similar techniques are principally used for the most of the targets, which are following: tenacious, repeatedly non-lethal poisoning, toxic gassing of targets' residence, etc., organized perjury, and a large number of people file false allegations of a kind of crime that is hard to prove against one target, electronic harassment, repeated break-ins, the interception of phone and computer, and so forth. Certain provisions in the pre-existing state and penal code can prohibit and punish the acts which constitute organized stalking, not only stalking provision, but also the provisions for the crime of soliciting a crime, crime of assault, and so forth. Yet the well-organized and permeated nature of this crime enables the perpetrator to hide the direct evidence of their deeds.
Could you wrap up, please?
Okay. The leaders of anti-organized stalking movement, including Robinson, who have facilitated a network of targeted individuals, found that these techniques of attacks are engineered to make the target's experience resemble the diagnosed delusional disorder or paranoid subtype of schizophrenia.
Okay. And, excuse me.
Yeah, okay, the last one. I'd like to make a special topical presentation on organized stalking and contribute to legislative discussion in the next legislative meeting.
All right, if you could hand in your statement, we can put the whole thing in the minutes since you've got it written there. Just pass it up.
All right.
Great, thank you very much. Is there any other member of the public who would like to address the legislature? Thank you. I see Herb Engman in there, in the back there. Herb, welcome. Thank you for coming.
Good evening, everyone. I continue to have people come up to me and ask why local governments don't work together. And I'm perplexed by that because I wanted to reiterate something I said the last time, that there's a great deal of intermunicipal cooperation going on in this community, and I'm most impressed, quite frankly, with the county. Both legislators and staff have been absolutely wonderful. I've been connected for 30 years with county government, and this is the most collaborative I've ever seen, and the leadership has been just remarkable. So thank you again for that. I wanted to thank you also for your efforts on the Hanshaw Road situation. I realize you have had a rough road, even rougher than the Hanshaw Road on that one. And several iterations of the town board have been very firm in their belief that we do need a sidewalk along Hanshaw Road, and we're very supportive of that, and I wanted to also reiterate that. I've been reading a bit about your proposal for a mortgage tax increase. I think that's a good idea. We certainly need to look for those ways of raising money that do not necessarily hit people more than, you know, a few times in their lifetime, and this would be one of them. And if you do need any support on that, I think we'd be happy to provide that because we see the importance of it. Finally, I just wanted to mention that we are zooming along on our comprehensive plan for the town. We are looking for input from any and all who have opinions about what the town of Ithaca should do in the future and what it should look like. We've done several major things. One, we did a survey of our residents, which is very, very interesting. If you would like to take a look at it, it's on our website. We had a large number of focus groups where we sought out experts in various categories like housing, energy, transportation, education, health, and so we picked up a lot of new ideas from them. And then we have just completed a series of neighborhood meetings where we went to the neighborhoods, asked people about what they would like to see in the town of Ithaca. And at the risk of oversimplification, I think I could generalize by saying the biggest concerns are the pace of residential development in the town and traffic and the speed of that traffic. Those are probably two of the most concerned about items. The most positives have been the idea of access to services while enjoying open space, and that open space includes farms, parks, trails, and just the availability of all that. Those areas of the town which have trails are just absolutely overjoyed with them. And so we know we're on the right track in trying to build sidewalks and trails to help people get around their neighborhoods. So again, I would urge you to visit our website if you are interested in learning more about our comprehensive plan process. And we'd greatly appreciate any input you'd like to give. Thank you.
Great. Thanks a lot, Herb. Are there any questions for Herb? Carol.
Yeah. Herb, thanks for your comments on the trails and the sidewalks and bike paths. I just wanted to make sure that you were aware that we held a meeting, sort of an introductory meeting, about the Pine Tree Road project, and there was a large attendance of people who were not entirely happy about the preliminary plans for that project, and anything that you would like to do to coordinate or have your planners coordinate with ours would be appreciated.
Yeah, I in fact fielded one telephone call today. I think the major concern is the potential for increased truck traffic with the changing of the bridge. And I think the best thing we can do is to try to work with Cornell to designate truck routes for their deliveries, because I suspect that's one of the major users of Pine Tree Road. The other is that apparently a lot of the global positioning programs tend to show people the shortest route, but they don't necessarily show them the best route in terms of neighborhoods. And we've had that problem in Forest Home, where we get tractor trailers captured at the bottom of Warren Road because there's no place to go. You cannot get out of there in a tractor trailer. So we have some of these issues in the town that, yeah, we need to work on. But the major concern, I think, is the potential for increased truck traffic on Pine Tree Road.
Frank?
Herb, Ithaca College just announced that they're going to be looking at more development up on South Hill with the apartments in, I think it's College Circle.
Mm-hmm.
They want to knock down four buildings and replace them with nine.
Mm-hmm.
And increase the rooms. Does the town get to review that project?
Yes, we're reviewing that right now. There are about 253 new beds that will be added in that whole process. This, I think, is part of the situation where Ithaca College increased its registration by about 300 students last year, and they put them in what were called temporary quarters, and we approved those temporary quarters, and this is part of the longer term, I think, solution to that increased enrollment. We're not too concerned about some items like traffic, because there's an interior road to campus that we think most students will take. So that it won't increase tremendously the 96B traffic, I don't think. But it's always a concern, and that's what's being looked at right now.
Well, I want to put my TCAT hat on for just a second. We have a new procedure that through Pam's committee at TCAT was developed, that any new development where they may ask for increased bus service or an impact on bus service, that TCAT has to be brought in to the discussion, at least so that there's some exposure, so they don't assume, so the developer doesn't assume that they'll just, the bus will come for whatever reason more than it did before. So I would defer to Pam maybe to describe that, but at some point it might be good, if they haven't met with the TCAT folks, they may want to do that.
And I just made a note of it, so I will check on that to make sure that they, if they haven't, that they will.
Right. I'll just add that that actually, we haven't finalized that process yet, but it's certainly something that TCAT is trying to get in at the beginning of these discussions so that they don't get a call as the building is being or the development's being built saying that they expect bus service, because it's just not feasible. We can't just appear. It has to fit into our program. So it's to help developers, it's to help planning boards, it's to help communities come up with sort of a plan.
Well, the other one that I would assume there should be contact with is Conifer on West Hill. So I don't know if that has taken place, but certainly we'll suggest both. Thank you.
Anything else for Herb? Peter, go ahead.
Not a question, just a comment, just to follow up on what Herb said about about the GPS, excuse me, the GPS map function is that if you look on MapQuest from Cornell to any place from Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Scranton, all takes you up Pine Tree Road. So any traffic from those directions takes you to Cornell through Pine Tree Road, which I guess it doesn't surprise anyone who's seen the traffic on Pine Tree Road.
Well, and I, as I said at the meeting, it is the goal of a sort of layered transportation system that especially trucks would stay on state routes as long as possible before getting off to make their local deliveries. And if they're going to East Hill Plaza or Cornell, those are local deliveries. So there's a reality there. And I'm sure the Pine Tree Road folks go to East Hill Plaza for their shopping. So, it's a domino effect. If you change one thing, it affects traffic flow on many other routes. But I think they've raised good concerns, and it's something that I know that the county planning and highway are looking at, and I think that the I know that Cornell and the town were working together. This is part of the TGIS, the transportation environmental impact study that was worked spent a long time in a collaborative process. So I don't know what we can do about the mapping programs, but Herb, I just wanted to mention that you've been a real partner in intermunicipal work, and especially a leader on the cell tower project that we've been, it's been slow going, but we've been really working to try to get something collaborative going on that, and it's been great to have a partner at the town. So thank you.
Thank you.
Legislators, anyone that privilege of the floor for legislators? Anyone have something to say? And I would just, Simon from the Journal, is that you're Simon, right?
Yes.
Feel free to go where you need to go. So we got a warning from Stacy that you're going to be here. So,
okay.
All right, thank you. Frank, and then Nathan.
Thanks, Martha. I have a couple for you this evening. First, my consumer report on NYSEG and the Public Service Commission. In case you missed it, the rate increases that NYSEG has been asking for are on hold because of some of the items that several of you, and certainly I've been, I wish I could say I took credit for stalling this, but we just contributed to the process. Stay tuned, but none of them have been approved. Secondly, the other all-time favorite, the International Fund, that we've been trying to access for several years through the telephone companies and the feds. The state has now applied, along with New York City, for broadband money to the FCC, and that may come out of that fund. And those of you that have stayed tuned, I don't want to upstage Paula, but you may want to say something about that later, but that is good news that we may actually, through a side door, get some money there. TCAT, just to remind you, the budget presentation is the 28th of this month at noon at the library in the Borg Warner Room. If you haven't responded yet, we'd appreciate it if you would so we could get a head count. It would be nice to have as many representatives there as we possibly can, because this is going to be a tricky budget year, to say the least. And last of all, the on file here at the board office is the long-range plan. I'm the TCAT representative to the ITCTC, and they filed the long-range plan at for 2030 here, and it's about 4 pounds thick, but it covers all of the transportation projections that Fernando is looking at. Some of them affect the bus service. Most of them affect your towns. And Dooley is the official county representative for that, so I don't want to say any more than I should, but I'll defer to Dooley on any of that. But if you have a chance, look at this report, because it really is extensive, and there's millions of dollars on the line with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Nathan?
Just wanted to remind people that the Figure Lakes Dragon Boat Festival is this Saturday, July 10th in Cass Park. Starts around 8, 9 o'clock. That's when the teams will be getting there, and goes on until 5. We'll have throughout the day different, in addition to the races, we'll also have performances from the Cornell Shimta group, which is a Korean drumming group. Budok. Oh my gosh. Well, a Japanese foot stomping dance. And from the Amber Dance Troupe, which features Chinese dance from all over China, including from the western regions of China. So it's very interesting to see the diversity in dance there. They'll be there as well. We'll have a carnation ceremony that's for breast cancer, for cancer survivors and those who've fallen from cancer. We'll also have an eye donning ceremony featuring Joe and Martha as two of the eye daughters and a whole other set of dignitaries. So overall, it's going to be a great event. There's going to be a crafts fair. There's going to be wellness tents. It's going to be all consolidated in a central space in Cass Park. So it won't be like last year's festival where things were kind of on different places on different sides of the inlet, or in years past. So everything will be close by. I think it's going to be a great activity, and it's free. It's a great place to take your family, so I encourage you all to go. And I know we have a team, so that's fantastic in the community races. And I will be the co-MC, so I'm sorry if you don't like my voice, because you'll be hearing it all day Saturday. Thanks.
Does that mean you won't be paddling with us?
Oh, I'll paddle at that time.
Oh, okay.
Because otherwise, I'll just make fun of you guys, and you'll try to throw me inside of the inlet, like what happened last time.
All right, I'll just take a moment and talk this up to follow up on Nathan. Our boat is almost full. We do have space for one or two more, right, Karen?
One
definite. And it's always good to have a few backups for somebody who, where there's an emergency, they can't come. So please join us. Let Karen know if you want to paddle. Thanks. Many thanks to Sarah Reistetter and to Karen for organizing our team. And anybody, even if you can't paddle, you can participate by helping to sponsor. And we do need some more sponsorships, and it'd be really great if we could have 100% participation in that way from the legislature. Any amount will be a big help. So,
There's also 24 teams that are coming from all over the Northeast, and 6 from Canada as well. So it's truly an international Dragon Boat Festival.
So I don't know whether we'll find the dragon again, but
yeah.
Karen?
Is there a location for the cheering section for Tompkins County?
All along Cass Park, I suppose. Yeah.
Look for the WDIC tent. There's a.
Oh, okay. Oh, there's
a cheerleader with the orange pom poms.
Excellent.
You can. You'll be able to find us. I promise you. It's really a lot of fun. Peter.
Yeah, to get away from dragon boats for just 1 second and back to Pine Tree Road. It's not the traffic from those places I was talking about, from Boston to Philadelphia to East Hill Plaza, that's the issue. Those are already going on Pine Tree Road, and that's the natural way to go. It's on state routes, and then they go right on Pine Tree Road, as they should. The concern is those trucks which are going from that whole area from Boston to Philadelphia to Cornell, which now cannot go through Pine Tree Road because of the bridge, and are presumably going in a different direction, probably up Mitchell Street is my belief, which will surely be diverted to Pine Tree Road if, in fact, that bridge is rebuilt. That's the concern. So the East Hill Plaza doesn't really figure into it.
Well, that's something we're going to look into, and, you know, that's what our staff does. Nathan?
Oh, just to add to that, I think it will be interesting to see the effect that our patrols and speed traps have, especially in the next few years, because a lot of your GPS systems and the iPhone, too, are actually users are updating information about where these speed traps and where patrols happen to be. And so it's really changed the behavior of a lot of drivers in a lot of areas. And so I think that as that information becomes more updated, and as we have more police patrols and speed traps in certain areas, I think there will be a bigger effect because people will be looking out for it. I mean, it's not really happening here in Tompkins County yet. It's more of a, you know, in larger metropolitan areas, but I think that's rapidly changing.
Yeah. Anyone else? Frank and then Carol.
Thanks, Martha. You know, typical of Tompkins County, Nathan, I hate to say this, but there's always more than one event going on.
Yes.
While the Dragon Boat Races are going on next Saturday, the Danby Fair and Parade and Firemen's Field Days is also going on. The Celtic and Scottish Games are also going on. And Mike Lane has an event going on in Dryden at the library. So take your pick, right?
All are good choices.
They're all good choices, yeah. Right.
Carol?
Yeah. I'll say just a short thing about the Pine Tree Road still, is that I think that in all of these projects, I did not raise it to mean that that everybody had objections. I hear from just as many people from my area who would prefer that the traffic go on that route rather than the route, some of the routes they're currently taking, which is on some of the nearby streets. And I just think it's important on all of these projects, Hanshaw, Pine Tree, Varna, wherever we are looking at issues of traffic and trucks, that we need to distinguish the issues of route from that of speed and find good ways and methods to do that. I know there's also been suggestions lately that we should limit the discussion of privilege of the floor maybe in some way to only local items. And I find that, and I wanted to comment about that and say that I find it interesting sometimes if it's not extensive to hear something of what people are interested in that touches them or items in their lives that they find important. And in that vein, I wanted to mention that on July 4th, I happened to be with Thomas Jefferson, literally at his gravesite at Monticello, and there was a naturalization ceremony that went on just before I'd been there, and still people there who were just so thrilled to have been there and to have become citizens. And there's a very nice museum. Other than it being a very modest house, there's a very good museum there. And one thing that I didn't know about Thomas Jefferson that I found interesting that I wanted to share with you is that he was interested in city planning. And I take pictures of museum exhibits when I find them interesting. And I wanted to just let you know that Jefferson was one of the first people to advocate a comprehensive approach to city planning that considered site, transportation, and growth. He was instrumental in writing the Land Ordinance of 1780-something that I can't read, 84, which called for a gridiron overlay to settle part of the Western Territories uniformly, and it was his idea to plan in a checkerboard fashion city planning with alternating squares for building and open space, an area of turf and trees interspersed with city areas. So ideas that sometimes we think of as new, smart growth, areas that we think we're inventing, he was way ahead of us, and anybody who wants to hear more about that can come and hear about it from me. Thanks.
Mike.
As Frank mentioned, there's something going on in Dryden this Saturday, too. It's pretty historic, we think. It is the groundbreaking ceremony for the Lincoln Center addition to the Southworth Library, one of our rural libraries that Tompkins County supports, and we appreciate that. If you'd like to come out, we won't be a long ceremony, but we'd like to have you there about 10 a.m., and we're going to turn the sod, and we hope by 9 months from now, we'll have a new addition that we'll have a dedication. So come on out. The other thing I want to talk about, what else but our state budget process, and I want to point out that we've all have copies of Hank DeLay's article in the New York State Bar publication about the constitutional basis of the budget process, if there is any, presently. Can you imagine the New York State Senate taking its 4th of July holiday after deciding how to spend the money but not deciding how to have the revenues to pay for it? Well, that's what they've done. We need change. We need a lot of change. We have one of our members here who would like to get up there and change. Pam, we hope that you make it, and we hope that you tell them, give them a good piece of your mind. And one thing you don't do is spend the money before you figure out how to pay for it.
Amen. Thank you, Mike. Pat?
I'd just like to say thank you to Donnie and the other members of the community who have spoken here both at this meeting tonight and at the other meetings that we've had about the importance of the various programs in the community and the pain that is going to be caused by the situation that Mike has just described and continues to allude to. It's very hard to hear this kind of thing. And I know that I'm not speaking just for myself when I say that we all wish that we could do more to help these community groups and that we feel very frustrated too. And thank you for coming and telling us about your situations.
Thank you, Pat. Anyone else? All right, well, we have a distinguished guest and a presentation tonight about the TC3 budget. President Haynes, why don't you take the floor?
Okay. Thank you, Martha. Why don't I start off by giving you a brief overview of the budget proposal that's in front of you for your action tonight. Also, what we're planning as a contingency plan and the reasons for that, which I'll elaborate on. And then try to not get into a lot of detail, but enough, I hope, to address maybe the major questions you might have, and then obviously answer any other questions along the way. The budget originally as proposed that you're looking at tonight and hopefully be acting on assumes $130 reduction per FTE in our base aid rate from last year's budget. Importantly, it assumes the restoration of the additional cut of $285 per FTE in our base aid rate that the governor originally proposed as an additional cut from the mid-year cut that we took last December. At the time that we were working on our budget in March and April, the Assembly and the Senate, State Senate, had acted to fully restore that proposal. As recently as a week ago today, I had confirmation from our representatives in the state legislature that the Senate and the Assembly had further agreed that they would be restoring that to full $285. As we know, that's in jeopardy right now, and I'll speak more to that in a minute. This budget assumes a 5% increase in tuition. It assumes a 4.6% enrollment increase. When I shared this budget with the joint meeting of our legislatures, the Cortland and Tompkins legislatures, and our Board of Trustees in May, I pointed out that that was a very, in our view, very conservative enrollment with respect to next year. That's turning out to be the case, as well as the enrollment increase for the current year that we're finishing up was, again, very conservatively estimated. I'll speak more to both those numbers in a minute. The budget, as proposed right now, did assume two staff cuts, one administrative, one classified staff. It assumed a 50% reduction in the equipment portion of our budget, and it assumed an additional 10% reduction in the departmental operational budgets on top of the $400,000 reduction that we took in mid-year to accommodate the mid-year cut in state aid. And the budget assumes no increase in sponsor aid, which we've talked about before. I want to mention and address a question that I know has come up with respect to the maintenance of effort requirement that's in the state legislation. That requirement speaks to the need for, if a community college budget is to have more than one-third of its revenue derived from student tuition, then there's a requirement that the county sponsors, and I'll read this last portion, either in the aggregate or on a per full-time equivalent student shall be no less than the comparable actual rates for the previous year. Now, the per student support from the sponsors, and you need to keep in mind, every time I use the word sponsor, that's a collective sponsor with Tompkins and Cortland County. That's how the state looks at you as sponsors. It's a two-county contribution. Your sponsor contribution on a per full-time resident student is going down. So obviously, it's going down from 2170 to 2007. So it's going down by $160 per student. The reason why it's going down, there's more students, and the sponsor rate is staying the same. So obviously, the per student support is going down. So the only other criteria then is the flat dollar amount that you contribute. If that were to be reduced by as little as a dollar, it would cost us between $5.7 and $6 million. The reason I'm giving you that range is because if you look at the budget as is right now, it's $5.7 million. In a more worst-case scenario, that would go up because we're expecting enrollment to go up next year. It gets up close to $6 million. So that would be, as you can imagine, more than devastating on our budget. Let me speak to the that kind of gives you a very brief overview in terms of the budget as we knew it a week ago. We have met our executive council twice within the last few days. The governor has vetoed the Assembly and Senate efforts to restore the $285. Okay, the governor has vetoed that. In my discussions with both Senator Seward, Assemblywoman Lifton, as recently as earlier this afternoon, the state budget, as we all know and was just commented on here, is still not approved. So there's some hope. There's still a ray of hope out there until that's done. You know, they're still subject to some negotiations that may be going on. On the other hand, the strength of the veto makes it more challenging and the politics of it more uncertain. So we have taken steps to try to figure out, okay, what do we do if that were to happen? And fortunately, our enrollment increases are looking very strong, and that's going to help us in more than just a significant way. We're right now 14% as of this morning, 14%. Last week it was 14.3, 14.5% up over last year at the comparable time. That's double the rate of increase that we were projecting when we developed the budget. Summer school this year is up 9%. Our concurrent enrollment program is up greater than, again, we projected. We are taking some steps to reduce staff on top of the two positions that we've already cut. We'll be partly reducing by a minimum of 4.5 additional positions, two that are
vacant positions, and the other 2.5 would be positions that are currently staffed. So, bottom line is that while we know we can have, you know, I guess the other point I was going to make is that the enrollment increase that assumes for next year is 10.3%. It's about between 5 and 6% more than we have this year. It's still within the realm of possibilities, but on the other hand, it's not exactly where I have a great deal of comfort. And that's why we are taking the steps that we are to not only reduce staff, but of course we have a number of other areas that we're looking at in the budget to affect reductions. So we have a long history of managing our own budget and managing the outcome of that budget in a way that we believe continues to provide the services that you, as our legislature and a partner in our enterprise, we believe expect, and to serve the students that are coming to us at this time and their need to get prepared for new careers, to take advantage of the lower cost of a community college education, to propel them into upper division colleges in the area, and so on. So we believe we can sustain that kind of effort at the same. And of course, I'm not going to repeat all the other things we've done to kind of contain costs. There's a long laundry list of that as well. But we believe we can manage the outcome. The budget you're acting on tonight is still kind of up in the air in terms of what the state's doing. We can submit that budget with adjustments that we can make on the revenue side, and then we'll manage it to the outcome depending on how the year unfolds for us, both in terms of the actual enrollment increases and our need to manage expenses. So that's a lot of information, okay, some of which is new tonight because all of this has kind of unfolded in the course of the last, literally the last week, in the course of the holiday week and so on. It's been a short week. But I'd be happy to answer any other specific questions that you might have or anybody might have.
Thank you very much, Carl. Mm-hmm. Peter and then Frank.
Two bottom line questions. Compared to last year, what's the change in your total expenses? And compared to last year, what's the change in the number of students? All the projections, obviously.
The bottom line budget is increasing 2.2%. The original budget was assuming a 4.6% increase in enrollment, and we're modifying that to 10.3%. In terms of the adjustment, that's assuming that, in fact, the proposed restoration of the base aid rate, the governor's cut, does not get restored. That would be the assumption.
And you feel that the education that you deliver to these students will not be negatively impacted by this? Or it sounds to me like it must be if it's spending 8% less per student.
I'll tell you partially how that's being accommodated. It's much more complex than what I'm going to suggest, but to your point about quality. Number one, our primary focus, okay, in looking at where staff cuts would occur is that we're preserving the direct support for what we call our core enrollment, fall, spring enrollment. That's the priority, okay? So other areas outside of that core will be affected by reduction in staff. Secondly, we're quite blessed in this area to have the wealth of people qualified to teach for us on an adjunct basis. And while you've heard me say many, many times that we're over the line in terms of where I think we need to be in terms of the percentage of our instruction delivered by adjunct faculty, that envelope is being pushed a little bit further because at least two of the positions that we won't be filling are faculty positions. So the quality is being picked up by a greater reliance on adjunct faculty, which, of course, costs less.
Frank?
Thanks, Martha. We live in interesting times, huh, Carl?
We sure do.
Two questions, two different topics. One, can you say something about the effectiveness of the service centers, both in downtown Ithaca and in Cortland, and whether they'll be impacted by anything from the state? And secondly, we were running, or you were running, a pretty effective exchange program, the international program. Can you say if there's any, how that's going, B, is there any hope for more income? I know that was a really good income source.
And I didn't comment on that earlier, and that's I'm glad you raised that question.
The service centers.
Service centers. Okay, thank you. Had a senior moment there for a minute. Our extension centers in both downtown here and the new one in Cortland, or the soon-to-be new one in Cortland, are doing very well. And no, they're not going to be impacted by the cutbacks. The state is funding our rental aid, which is going to pay for the half of the cost of that center in Cortland that we're building. And frankly, as we look at, I'm looking short term now, when I talk about short term, the next 2 or 3 years, for our enrollment growth, we're going to have to program in a way that makes a little bit more reliance on our extension centers, because we're going to be pretty tight on space on the main campus. With respect to the international, that is, at the time that I presented this budget in May, you recall that we had a great deal of uncertainty with respect to our Disney program, which has proven to be quite beneficial to us revenue-wise, and that was at risk. And we did not budget anything for that program. We took the staff out of the budget as well as the revenue on the budget. That is looking very good again. In a discussion we had about 10 days ago with the Disney folks, they have had a verbal commitment from the Department of State to reaffirm their issuance of visas for the Disney program. Now, as of earlier today, they still hadn't gotten that in writing, and they're not prepared to give us the go-ahead until they do. But the tenor of the discussion with us has been very, very positive, and they view that as something they should be getting literally any day. So that will give us, that's another one of the little safety valves in terms of our enrollment scenario. There's just a lot of aspects of that that are playing out right now, but that's one that we believe, if we don't quite make a goal on one side, we've got this program, we've got additional students we understand coming from China this year, and so on. So a reason to be a little optimistic on that particular front.
Can I ask one follow-up on that, Martha? Carl, on the extension centers, with the increased reliance, as you mentioned, now the one in Cortland is not completely off the ground.
That'll be operational a year from now.
But the one in Ithaca at M&T, with the M&T building, is there any way to working with the city? Everybody's going to eat lunch. And if you're going to be relying more on increasing over the next year or so the use of that center, is there any way to promote that so that the economic impact on the city, the positive impact on the city, you could take a little bow for that? Would you know what that might be?
Well, we certainly know the traffic and
beyond Cassinetti's hot dog stand.
we certainly know the use of the facility. We could generate those kinds of numbers, both in terms of the credit courses we offer there, as well as the non-credit training that we do there, plus just the regular community usage of some of the rooms there for various kinds of community meetings. So we do track all that. I could generate those kinds of numbers if somebody wanted it. I don't know how you go from there to, we'll say, sales tax revenue or something of that sort. But
Gary Ferguson might be really interested in hearing what you have to say.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if he doesn't have a good feel for it anyway, but that would be a good point that I can bring to his attention.
Thanks. Thanks, Martha.
Jim? Carol?
I think Caroline.
Carol's next.
Okay. Carl, thanks for coming.
Sure.
Can you talk a little bit about your enrollment policy and whether you have considered or had to make any changes to that? Things like selectivity, do you have discretion, full-time versus part-time students, or local students versus from elsewhere in New York? I know that one's a complicated issue, but so have you had to consider that, any changes to enrollment?
We're not considering any changes in that regard. Let me try to comment, however, to the core message, or core point, I think, in terms of selectivity. With the exception of the nursing program, okay, which is somewhat selective, we're an open access institution. By definition, all of the community colleges in New York are, which, by the way, means we're supposed to be getting 40% of our funding from New York State, okay, which happened once back in the 70s. But that's what it means. We made that commitment back then as a full opportunity open access institution. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody gets into can matriculate in a program just because they want to. Okay, there are prerequisites that we have, academic prerequisites in terms of basic skill levels, where students are, if they don't meet certain criteria, they're counseled into credit equivalent, non-credit, basic skills courses to get their skill level up to where they can do successful academic work at a college level. International students, for example, getting back to that, there's kind of minimum sort of TOEFL scores that students need to have and or testing that we would do to assure that they can succeed in our English for Speakers of Other Languages program. If they're below that level, where our level of courses, they wouldn't be able to succeed there, then they're referred to a BOCES program or someplace else. So it's not like that somebody can just has the automatic right to come in. There is a counseling, advisement, and assessment process that's done, because our primary focus is we don't want to just take their money and then let them flounder and fail. We want to increase the opportunity they have to succeed. And so that's how we handle all that. With respect to pretty much the answer to the rest of the points, whether it's full-time, part-time, in-county, out-of-county, what school districts and all that, that's pretty much a market-driven kind of thing, where they come from. Obviously, we have had greater numbers of students coming from outside the sponsoring counties as a result of our student housing that we have. But we've also seen a greater increase in the percentage of students coming from the local high schools. So we've seen growth pretty well balanced between both of those. And as you know, when we get a student from outside the county, that gives you a big boost in the sponsor share, if you will, to the other counties sending us money instead of you sending us money. So anyway, I hope, does that address?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay, sure.
And Jim.
Martha, at the end of this discussion, I would request that we move the agenda item up so that we may vote on it while Carl is still here.
Without objection, I think that's a good idea. Dooley and then Mike.
Carl, I'm not sure whether I misheard you. Did you say there may come a time in the near future when you would want to submit a revised budget to the county, to the sponsors?
I don't think I said that, but I think that there's a by the time we get to next April and May in next year's budget, we'll know pretty much where we stand, whether we've been able to manage the outcome as based on how our revenue picture turns out and what we've been able to do to manage the expense side to make sure we have a finish the year with a balanced budget. The absolute worst case scenario that I can imagine is if things get very bad, we may have to submit a modified budget for your consideration and draw a little bit down on our fund balance to balance a budget. But we've never had to do that. We have some reserves of our own, and as I stand here today, I think the chances or the odds of that are very remote. I believe that we'll be able to manage the outcome. Yeah. If we got another severe mid-year cut, that would hurt us pretty significantly right now. Other than that, why? I'm going back a lot of years for some of you, okay, but 14, 15 years ago, we went through, in some respects, a much worse situation when enrollment was declining, so we didn't have the benefit of enrollment growth, okay, to offset what was occurring at that time.
And we're a two-year budget period. We laid off or reduced positions 14% of our employment base. We laid off 25 people. Those were tough days. We're not in that scope of challenge. And I've led the institution since then and have been kind of proud of the fact that we never wanted to go back there again. It's so hard to look people in the eye and have to tell them that their jobs are over, even with the benefits that they have for transition. But by the end of this week, first of next week, we'll be doing that, albeit on a much limited scale than we have before.
Mike.
Carl, could you comment on action by Cortland County on the budget and also the shift in shares?
Shift in shares?
The percentage.
Oh, yes, County. Yes. Cortland County approved the budget on June 24th, and the there is a shift in terms of the dollars. While the I'll get to that piece of paper here. There's a three-year average that the counties agreed to some years ago in terms of the ratio of students coming from the two counties, and that ratio determines how you divide up the sponsor share. So while the sponsor share is staying the same, that ratio has moved 1% to your disadvantage. So your share will be increasing next year by $42,549. Cortland share will be going down by the same amount of dollars. So the total sponsor share, however, is still the same.
Joe, and then Will.
Just one point of clarification. It came up in the committee about language in the second resolved, and this really piggybacks on what President Haynes is saying. The reference to the approved plan in the second resolve is exactly what Carlos is talking about. It's the plan to allocate the cost between the two sponsor counties. You just heard our share is about 63%. The dollar amount on that is $2,638,000. So again, in terms of the clarification of language, that's what the reference to the approved plan is about. It's that allocation between the two sponsoring counties.
Could I just comment further on that point for clarification? The reason that I think there's no dollars mentioned in your resolution is because many years we haven't known that ratio until after the close of the budget year. It's been that close. There was a time when this ratio was going year to year, and you know, we wouldn't know until the summer enrollment is finalized whether the ratio shifted or not. So that's why no dollar amounts are ever really mentioned in your resolution. This year, I think it's pretty clear which way it's going to go. I don't think our summer enrollment's going to move it one way or the other from what we know right now. So that's not the issue this year. But other years, there's been uncertainty, and that's why the language is as it is, which sounds a little vague, but that's what it means.
Joe, could you repeat the number again?
Yeah, I'll give you the exact number. It's $2,638,047. Is that correct, Carl?
That's correct.
Thank you, Joe. Will?
Carl, I just wanted to make sure I heard you correctly. In the maintenance of effort requirement, you said that were we to reduce by even a dollar, that could, in this budget, that could dramatically have profound impacts in terms of the amount we got to the state. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But that's based on dollar amounts as opposed to the per student ratio. Is that correct?
It's or, but you don't meet the per student number, so that's why the flat dollar amount is pertinent.
Okay. Right. And thank you very much for coming and explaining this. It's
happy to do it. Part of the deal.
And of course, that maintenance of effort requirement doesn't hold to the state. So.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, Arthur, because not only does it hold for the state, but that right now is one of the big issues for the state university campuses in terms of wanting to get more flexibility for tuition increases within SUNY rather than the legislature. And yet, you know, the state's not willing to maintain effort to do so. So it's, yeah.
Right.
Good point.
Any other questions for Carl? Jim, you want to take the motion?
Thank you very much. I want to Move adoption of the 2010-2011 budget, Tompkins-Cortland Community College, with a couple of changes. The resolution that you're looking at says July 6, 2010. It should say September 1, 2010. And in the last number in the fiscal year should say 2011 and not 2010. And I would move that and offer an apology. I think what happened in the transition from the administration to alleged, we inadvertently got the numbers wrong. This resolution came, I have a resolution that came from TC3 that has those numbers in that I just said. So
okay,
I would move that with those minor, with those changes.
All right, seconded by Frank. So tell us again, in the second resolved, you're saying the date should be?
Effect of September 1, 2010, and the last number instead of 2010 is 2011.
Okay, everybody got that? Dooley.
Jim, based on the explanation that I just heard from Joe, would it be correct to add parenthetically after September 1st, 2011 to explain the approved plan, parenthesis, i.e. the ratio of the two sponsor counties' shares based on the three-year rolling average of their student enrollment? Is that the concept?
Yeah, it is, but in looking back over other resolutions, I've never seen those words, and I think it's an understanding that we now are aware of. So I in fact would not really want to add that to the resolution at this point.
Frank.
Jim, could we add that? Sometimes we put notes on the bottom of the resolutions. Can we add that as a note? So there's at least the clarification.
So we don't ask the same questions each year, was my thought.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't have a problem with adding a note, but you know, I'm not going to guarantee that they're not the same questions I don't ask every year.
Why not?
Those questions are actually helpful to the
That's
public
right.
and to some of us legislators.
That's
who need
right.
to be reminded every year.
Okay.
To keep asking their questions.
Please add the note if you would do that, Catherine.
Are there any other questions or comments? Pat?
And I'm wondering about that figure that we were given, $2,638,047.
Yes.
Could that be included in there someplace, since it's a little more specific? This language seems... it's only with an explanation that I understand what it meant, and for the average person reading this,
my answer to that is, and this may be accepted or not. If you're going to write a note, then maybe a one sentence line about how much Tompkins County pays and how much Cortland County pays
yeah.
might answer that. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think that would work.
Yeah.
You know, keep in mind the official document that the resolution references is the budget
right.
document that you have, presumably, and that references the sponsor share.
Okay.
And so,
and everything is open to change.
And the record includes our, you know, this discussion. Mistake. Our minutes include this discussion with the elaboration of the information. I think. Since you've said you're not, you know, you don't have the exact numbers yet, the exact percentage yet, I think that's...
Well, this year I don't think it's going to change. I was making my point that, you know, I think the resolution was kind of patterned after previous resolutions,
right.
and there have been years where we didn't know. So that's, I think, the reason for the language.
Just a point of order. Is there a resolution actually on the floor? Was there
yes.
a second?
Yes. Yes.
Jim moved it.
And Frank seconded it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. Pat, you want to finish?
Yes, I just wanted to say that upon initially looking at this resolution, I was concerned because it seemed that we were going to be supporting TC3, which I think is a fine and a very good thing to do, but that we were not going to be looking for the same kind of attempt or effort to cut their budget that we were asking from our own internal departments and so on, because we were proposing a budget the same as last year's, and so that was somewhat problematic for me. But I do want to say that after listening to the discussion and talking with people about it, especially the information presented tonight by Dr. Haynes, that I'd like to I feel much more comfortable with this, because it's very apparent that there have been, first of all, there have been serious cuts made through the process. It's already happened before this resolution came before us. And also that we're really in a bind given the state's requirement for maintenance of effort. So given those two factors, I feel I will be able to support this.
Thank you, Pat. Anyone else? Ready to vote, then. All in favor of the resolution, please raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? That passes unanimously.
Great. Thank you very much. And we are in very unprecedented, uncharted waters at this point, so I'll continue to keep, of course, Joe informed of any developments, as well as your budget committee and the full board at any time that you'd like me to do so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again for your support.
Thank you very much, Carl.
One comment. We will be, and Mike Lane included in this, will be looking at what actions the state legislature does to decide what their revenue side of their budget. We're anxiously awaiting all of that. So hang in there and get back to it.
Sure will.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Carl.
Great. Thank you.
For my report, first I want to let you know something that Marcia sent out a press release already, but I wanted to just emphasize this so that anybody listening and sweating out there, I mean, it's cold in here, we got our jackets on, but the county, together with the Red Cross, the American Red Cross, have opened two cooling centers for people without air conditioning. They're open to anyone, no cost, etc. The Greater Ithaca Activity Center, the new, beautiful new GAC, 318 North Albany Street, from 1 o'clock tonight to 7 p.m. And the Friends Hall, Campus Road at Cornell, that's at the east end of the Scholkoff Complex near the stadium and across from Teagle Hall. That's from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. Tuesday, 2 to 8 p.m. for the rest of the week. How's this written? 4 to 8 today and 2 o'clock to 8 o'clock p.m. the rest of the week. This is really like no kidding around kind of weather, and people can really be damaged, can really become ill with this kind of weather. So if anybody knows people out there, you know, senior citizens especially, who may not have, you know, a lot of mobility and they need some help, there is help available. Again, GAC till 7 p.m. tonight. Friends Hall at Cornell till 8 o'clock. They don't have the ability to have overnight accommodations at this point, but I'm sure that if anyone calls, the other idea is if you call 211, our local the local helpline, call 211 and they will direct you to whatever help you need, and people really, this needs to be taken seriously. It's bad out there. So, a couple of other things, and again, that the full information I trust will be in the media. I think the Marcia's already taken care of that. A couple of other things about looking at our budget coming up. We had a couple of meetings ago a meeting of committee chairs. To start talking about program inventories. And you've heard me talk a little bit about having some time during program committee meetings in July to spend extra time on our budgets, on the department budgets, and on the program inventories. Joe and I would like to suggest that committee chairs, that we have another meeting as soon as possible, and we've gotten a couple times, we'll send out a message trying to make sure everybody can come. So committee chairs to sit down together and look at where we stand and what the proposals look like. Any of the legislators, of course, is welcome to join us. So as soon as we have got that time, we'll let you know. And vice chairs especially, I know that one of our chairs won't be here during most of the month of July. So we have usually spent time during our July meetings hearing our department heads go through their budget proposals, and it's partly a chance to inform each committee. It's also partly for us to give them feedback as it's before they finalize their request to Joe. August 1st is the deadline for their request into Joe, so July is an important month for this. Now, facilities, public safety, F&I, public safety have already had their July meetings, and PDEC is having its meeting tomorrow. So I would really encourage those committees to look for a time later in the month of July, to have a special meeting on these issues. And Kathy Covert's generously said she'd be glad to help you schedule those meetings. It really is important as a time to get us ready and to have some kind of perspective on what's going to be handed in to Joe and to have some feedback on that. So I hope that's hope that can be worked out. I think it'll be time very well spent.
With regard to that, are you saying we should have a second meeting to discuss preliminary budget items, but will the sheets that the individual departments prepared, will those be available for that meeting also?
Those program inventories?
Yes.
I was going to ask Joe about that. I sent an email. Yeah.
Yeah, those will be out, and I was going to include that in my report. Those should be out within the next few days.
Oh, good.
So we're polishing those up right now, and again, those should be available to all members of the legislature within the next few days.
Thank you.
And those would be, we're going to get those electronically and hard copy.
That's right.
And so everybody will have all of them. So it'll be a chance for committees to pick their section in the notebook.
Will the members of the legislature receive copies of all of them?
Yes, that's our plan. I know we can do it through a PDF, so we can send it out electronically as a bundled batch of reports. The first series will be only the departmental programs. It won't be the agencies. Those have a different deadline or coming in on a different schedule. But the departmental information will come out electronically as a complete batch of programs.
Okay, thanks.
So I specified F&I, Public Safety, and PDEC because of their schedule. And, you've already talked about having a special meeting for HHS anyway. GO, you might have time to adjust that. I don't know if your agenda is really set for July 15th. But
we also have to have a special meeting, too.
Right, right. So there's, were you planning a special one for another topic or for this?
No, for the computer-aided dispatch. Okay.
For the what?
Computer-aided dispatch.
Right. Okay. All right. So we'll all be busy this month, and it's important and time well spent. So Kathy will be in touch with you about scheduling those meetings. Okay. That's my report. Oh, except again, help us out with the dragon boat. Thank you.
Thank you,
County Administrator.
Thank you. I think the order of the evening is the state budget. You've heard about it from a couple of different perspectives already tonight. I just want to share with you some of the information that we have and to highlight an issue that seems to be emerging that is very troubling to us with respect to the mortgage recording tax. First on, with respect to the spending cuts that have been proposed in this budget, we are still sorting through these cuts. They're getting into somewhat better focus right now, but it's going to take a few days for us to really understand how these large lump sum cuts affect our individual programs and departments. I will tell you that the information is beginning to come in now from departments. Lisa Holmes is here tonight. I got an email from Lisa today indicating that some of these cuts will affect core programs that we offer in our aging services area. I know the health department is bracing for cuts in some of its core areas, including home care. Probation is expecting a cut in the reimbursement formula that it receives from the state. DSS is looking at cuts in child welfare areas. So we are really bracing for cuts throughout this budget. And we'll report to you as soon as we have details on that as to where those cuts are and what kind of an impact they may have. So we certainly have concern there, and we'll continue to focus on it. We also have a concern on the revenue front. And this doesn't speak so much to 2010 as it does to 2011, and it relates to the mortgage recording tax. Just for background, I think it's important to know that even though the state hasn't approved its revenue budget yet, the state is proposing significant increases in its own taxes, all the way from cigarette taxes to the restoration of taxes, sales taxes on clothing and shoes that will go back into place. There's a deferral of business tax credits that were granted under economic development programs. It's really a takeaway of the benefits of businesses, represents a tax increase. There's a reduction of itemized deductions for charitable giving by wealthy individuals that has caused our not-for-profit community great concerns. So there are a variety of tax increases that are woven into the state budget imposed by the state. In spite of that, a willingness to increase state taxes, the state Senate has indicated that it will draw the line on approving home rule requests for local governments that have an impact on revenues. So, for example, our home rule request that we be granted the opportunity to implement a mortgage recording tax of 0.25% instead of either cutting programs or raising property taxes more, that request to make a decision locally about that revenue source is being blocked in the Senate, as are all similar requests that relate to local revenue increases. So there are several counties, I recall 8 or 9 counties, that have asked for the same kind of increase in their mortgage recording taxes that we've asked for. There are several counties that have asked to implement a surcharge on their landline telephones to help pay for their emergency communication systems, as we did. There are some counties that have asked for an extension of existing sales tax rates that have expired this year. And as a group, those requests are being denied in the state Senate. I think the pitch is that they are trying to show that they are against increases in local taxes. In fact, this isn't at all about increasing local taxes. It's about home rule and about local governments having a much better sense of what's right for their own communities and how to best balance their own budgets than Albany does. Still, we're in a box right now, and it looks very, very difficult to get this situation changed. Now, if we have any luck at all, or had any luck at all, it's in the fact that the legislature didn't shut down last week. They didn't adjourn and go away. There's still another week or so to go before adjournment will happen. So I will tell you, we have launched a lobbying effort here that is intended to try to reverse this decision or break the logjam on these home rule requests. We are enlisting NYSAC in that effort. We've talked to other counties, and we are trying to get all of us who were affected by this year to rally behind an effort to overturn that. I will tell you that there are concerns not only about what happens this year with this particular tax, but if this becomes a precedent for the state legislature to, out of principle, deny home rule requests, there are some huge issues on the horizon. You recall that we have to go back every 2 years to get our sales tax renewed. And if this becomes the way it gets played out in Albany, there are some enormous implications that we're looking at. Very quickly, I'll tell you what happens if the 3%, or if the mortgage recording tax doesn't happen. Remember, that's 0.25% on mortgages. It's $1 million to our budget next year. And $1 million in our budget, if we don't have it in the form of a mortgage recording tax, we have bookends on what we can do. We can either cut expenditures or raise property taxes. At either end of that spectrum, if we have to make up that $1 million in lost mortgage tax revenue by cutting expenses, we will have to direct our departments to cut their non-mandated spending by another 3% next year. That's 3% on top of a 6.9% cut we've already basically dictated to the departments for next year. So with that, we'd be looking at a 10% across-the-board cut in all non-mandated expenditures in the county next year. The other end of the spectrum is to just raise it through property taxes instead of mortgage taxes. To do that, we would have to raise our property taxes by 3%. And that's 3% on top of a targeted 5% increase in levy. So that would mean an 8% increase in property taxes, or some combination thereof. So the impacts of what's happening right now in Albany are very consequential to this county, and in fact to all counties who are in the same box that we are. So with respect to what Martha talked about and trying to pull the committees together quickly to begin looking at next year and programs and so forth, there's probably greater urgency in that task now than there was before we learned that the state, the Senate was going to be blocking these home rule requests. So we definitely have our work cut out for us. Our expectations began low in terms of what to expect for next year. I think we have to adjust those expectations even lower, and again, start with an aggressive lobbying effort, see if we can change it. If we can't change it, we have to begin to basically incorporate this into our decision-making for the 2011 budget. So, again, I often bring you difficult news. This is a very difficult bit of information to bring to you. And I guess I would enlist anybody in the effort of lobbying the Senate, and it's all in the Senate, to help overturn this. So that's the state budget. If anyone has any questions on that, I can, before I turn to my next.
Jim topic. And then Frank.
And Joe, you thankfully didn't mention the FMAP money that takes care of Medicaid and where that is in the federal budget, unless something has changed recently.
Right. Well, that's something that in setting up our budget expectations for 2011, we said from the very beginning, and the legislature was right there, was let's not spend it before we know it's going to be there. Let's hold it back in case it doesn't come. If it does come, that's a hedge against other negative things that can happen. So it sure looks as if that FMAP money is not going to come out of Congress. The state's certainly lobbying for it, and if the state doesn't get that money, that's another $1 billion that it's going to have to try to find in its own budget process.
I'll just mention that this morning in Dryden, Mike Arcuri was there to talk about an initiative on related to gas drilling, and Mike and Pam were also there, and not to waste any opportunity, pigeonholed him about FMAP, and he's very much in favor of the federal share going, staying in there. They're not sure whether they can get the votes for it, but I was pleased to hear that because he's been, as a Blue Dog Democrat, he's been tighter than others on spending. So I was very pleased to hear that he was very supportive of it, and he certainly understood the impact for us. Frank?
Thanks, Martha. On the FMAP, the reading over the weekend was that they were going to deal with that either this week or next week in Washington, that it is supposed to come back up. So I'm glad to hear what you just said about Mike backing it. Joe, is there a companion effort being made to squeal about the mandates, and perhaps if I know the home rule piece is important, but unless we get some relief on what the state's ramming down our throat, and that's true of all counties too, on mandates, I know NYSAC has been supportive of that in the past, but is there going to be a second effort on that type of thing?
Well, there has been an ongoing effort on that front. And certainly when we responded to things like the proposal for a cap on local property tax increases, we reminded the state that one reason that local property taxes are going up is because the cost of mandated programs is going up, and especially pensions. I will say, Frank, that the expenditure side of the budget is pretty much locked in place at this point. The only outstanding part of this budget, as I understand it, is really on the revenue side and trying to lock that down. So it's through that side of the budget that we'll try to see if we can get the mortgage tax and the home rule items restored. We will continue to make our concerns known about mandates, because I think your point is they're not slowing down. There is still an enormous dependence on public services in this community and throughout the state, and those costs continue to go up. And there was an article in the paper over the weekend about pensions and about borrowing for pensions, and I don't know if you saw the fine print, but in the fine print, the state comptroller is indicating that the pension rate in 2015 could be 30%.
30%.
And we're concerned about next year that rate rising to 16% and the consequences that has to our budget. So that'll certainly be a part of our pitch to the state going forward.
Well, some of the people that have weighed in are behind your effort about the that five. Now they're talking instead of an 8% fee, a 5%.
It looks more like 5%.
And there's not universal support for borrowing from the state and depleting that fund even more because they're unsure about getting it. Keep it up.
Brian and then Carol.
Actually, I'm going to pass.
Carol.
Joe, I brought you back some Thomas Jefferson quotes about taxation and home rule, and but seriously, and on the rights and duties of the citizens to let their voices be heard. So in that vein, is there anything that we can do with all the phone calling we're doing to Albany these days? Do you want us to even pass anything tonight, take a break and write something, make calls, travel to Albany along with our counterparts from other counties next week?
Yeah, I don't know that a resolution is needed. I think the phone calls would be helpful. NYSAC is trying to organize a conference call tomorrow. I will say that Martha and I have reached out to a couple of folks already in the state Senate and to other counties to talk to them and let them know our concerns and try to enlist them in the effort. But yeah, phone calls to the state Senate would be very helpful and appropriate.
Kathy?
Joe, I just wanted to ask, is this effort at the state Senate a bipartisan effort?
Yeah, well, it's you know, the politics of Albany I'll never understand. At this point, neither side of the aisle is supportive of this.
So nobody's taking credit for it publicly.
Well, I don't think either side wants to be labeled as the side that advocated local tax increases. And again, Kathy, and I'm editorializing more than I usually do because I think this is really should be a concern to any local government. This county did this the right way. The decision to go forward with the request for a mortgage tax was very careful. To use the cliche, it was very transparent. It was a part of a public debate. It was put out to the public for comment. The public commented. We looked at all of the available options. Many of them were not so good. I mean, we really had a group of unattractive options. And we did what we felt was right and appropriate for this community, based on what we know about this community. And if we've reached the point where Albany is saying, we know that community better than you do, that's a real concern. It's a concern of principle to me. And it really does concern me about what it means for the next rounds of home rule requests, because it really does handcuff what can be done. We have two sources of revenue in this county that provide meaningful money, the property tax and the sales tax. The sales tax is very anemic, so if we don't have opportunities to mix up our revenue balance a bit, then we have really one revenue source to work with, and that's the property tax. So if the interest in Albany is to provide property tax relief, actions like this actually take us in the opposite direction.
Thanks. I'm glad that you went into detail about this because this increase was one I supported, and I haven't supported increases like this in the past, but it was clear to me that these are interesting times and times that require it. And if you extrapolate forward, just as you've done, if this option is taken away from us, increase on the property taxes is for many, much more regressive, and it narrows our alternatives as a local community. So I'm glad that you're on this, and many of us around here, I'm sure, will support you in whatever way we can, letters to the editor, phone calls, and as Carol suggested, we're willing to go to Albany occasionally.
Trouble is they ain't there right now, but they'll be there next week. I'm going to editorialize after Peter because I'll put myself in line.
I'm sorry, I didn't. Did you call on me?
You go ahead, and then I'm going to put myself in line after you.
Okay, As I understand it, the politics of this is pretty straightforward. It has to do with non-incumbent challengers who are challenging incumbent senators and said that Senator Mariani voted to raise taxes 87 times, and 85 of those 87 were home rule kinds of things, where in fact it was not that. And I can see in a tough year, it's going to be it'll be a very unusual senator who will put him or herself in the position of enabling those attacks by people who are running against them. But it seems to me what we ought to be asking for is not for them to put themselves on the line by doing it, but to just get out of that business entirely. It's never clear to me what the logic is as to why the counties and municipalities cannot be simply granted the right to raise certain kinds of taxations if they want to. Why does it have to be checked by the legislature? What is the sense in that? And I think that's really what we ought to be asking for, is simply to allow us, consider us as adults who can make intelligent decisions for themselves without asking the legislature to approve them. And then that lets them off the line. I don't know if that would require a constitutional amendment or whether it could just be done by legislation, but that's what I think is the right answer to it.
Do you have any sense of that? Any answer, Jonathan? Do you know the law at all?
The answer is no, it would not require a constitutional amendment. It would just mean that every time they approve these, like, say, the sales tax, that they not put a two-year limit on it. And, you know, the logic of putting the two-year limit and doing every one every 2 years escapes me.
There isn't. That's a really good point, Peter, and it is infuriating. And it's interesting, Ken Cornell at NYSAC, before he left NYSAC, sort of pointed this out a year ago, said this is where he saw this going, that they were going to start not approving our request. And I want to say there's a structural problem here. This is not just, oh, well, they're raising this tax instead of that tax. The structural issue is that they're raising all the regressive taxes, sales tax on clothing below $110, fees for various things. And even when they so-called, I guess, raise taxes on the wealthy, it's going to hurt the people who get the donations of the wealthy. It's not really going to hurt the wealthy at all. So instead of having the guts to raise income tax rates, especially on the wealthy, which have been cut and cut and cut over decades, they are choosing all the kinds of things that are going to hurt the people who can least afford it, including the cuts to services. And I would point out that our Medicaid budget, it's not just about the increase in Medicaid or other mandates. Our Medicaid budget is 29% of our property tax levy. If they took that over, like most states do, our property taxes could be less by 29%. And, you know, it just feels to me like cowardice and, the most regressive kind of trying to fill budget gaps. And I'm really glad that Joe got a little angry about this one. And, you know, you're much more polite than I am. So I hope that we can push back on this one. I don't know whether there's time. And that's the other problem, is that you don't find out until the, 11 and a half hour about this kind of thing when they try to run a government this way. So it's really frustrating.
I do have one other item in my report.
So we'll let you know if there are ways that you can help. Thank you.
This is an appointment. As you recall, we have conducted a search for the supervising attorney for the assigned counsel program that Wes McDermott was appointed interim supervising attorney shortly after the passing of Bob Stolpe. He's been serving that role since that time, which was in January. We have gone through a search process. The position was advertised. We only received a couple of applications for this position. It is a part-time job. It pays $31,000. It doesn't get any benefits. And it requires the individual who takes it to basically not take on any criminal work that is assigned by the program, because you can't assign yourself to a case. So there are restrictions on what the individual can do. It requires the person to have practiced law for 5 years, including 2 years in Tompkins County. So the marketing effort to find candidates for this was a local effort, but a very aggressive effort through the Bar Association and the various avenues that we follow to find applicants for these positions. Again, only two applied. The ABIR set up a committee, and it's really the ABIR that recommends the appointment to me. I, in turn, appoint, and the appointment is subject to your confirmation. And in reviewing the resumes, they are recommending that Wes McDermott, who's filled this position ably for several months, be appointed to the position permanently. I absolutely agree with that recommendation, and I would like to appoint Wes McDermott to that position. To do that, I need your confirmation. This did go to public safety at its last meeting. The committee did approve it, so I'm asking for your confirmation tonight so that we can make this permanent appointment.
Any questions? Is there anybody who would like to make such a motion? Nathan?
Yes, I'll move approving the county administrator's recommendation to appoint Wes McDermott as head of the assigned council program.
Thank you. And Pam seconds that. Any discussion? All right, ready to vote. All in favor of Wes McDermott's appointment permanently?
Aye.
Any opposed? That's unanimous. And our congratulations and gratitude to Wes.
Thank
you very much. Anything else, Joe?
No.
Thank you very much. County Attorney Jonathan Wood.
After Joe's report, my saying no report is going to sound pretty good. So I'll go with that.
Okay. So, you know, if you actually have one. Okay. Finance Director David Squires.
I guess I should just spread the bad news. But there is this pattern throughout New York State that the state has not been reimbursing counties for social service cost. Every county is getting nothing from Office of Children and Family Services for, and we pay benefits weekly, and you know, we get dribs and drabs. You know, the NYSAC did a survey. I mean, most counties are down several million dollars year to date from reimbursements. And today was the largest. I got $500,000 wired in today from for mental health services. But that's the largest amount we've gotten in 3 weeks, $500,000. It's been on the average of about $2,500 a day. So I suspect that there will be a liquidity emergency, you know, before the end of the summer. And we have the authority to borrow money based upon state aid. And if this pattern continues, we will have some problems, because during the summer we do have quite a bit of expenses going out the door.
Dave, can you say how far behind we are? What just in round numbers,
well,
what
the
are
end
we
of,
expecting?
Just in comparison, we lost $2 million in our balance at the end of May. Now, I can't point out where that, but you know, all things being equal, the our cash positions have been fairly stable. And at the end of April and May are when we're mostly flush because of property taxes coming in. And they have been coming in very well. At the end of June, we get the second installment in, and that's about 3,000 taxpayers remitting $3 million to the county directly after the installment program. So that helps us out, but it's really something I'm very concerned about, and everybody else around us is the same way, because while the benefits are being paid, the reimbursements aren't.
Do you have any sense of this is because the budget isn't complete?
There's been no notice about any explanation about what's going on. We just know that, you know, that if you had an income tax return submitted to New York State, they do everything in their power to not pay out the return. They've, you know, rejected a lot of returns so they could not have to disperse the income tax payments. I just think the recession has impacted very significantly. And, of course, the gyrations on Wall Street really dramatically affect the state's fiscal position. The only thing I would say, though, that our sales tax is still holding up for the month of June. The payments we got in for the month of June, the first two payments, were up about 12%, which is encouraging.
Okay.
Thanks. I know that it's a lot of different income streams and departments and reimbursements for different purposes. Is there any way to track what's owed over time and use that in our lobbying? This is what Frank was getting at. What do they owe us? Is there any way to get a handle on that?
Well, I mean, we have, the only thing you can compare is what the receivable from New York State is. And, it goes up and down from as low as $4 million to as high as $12 million. It was up at year end by almost $4 million over last year. And as the year progresses, claims are submitted and claims, which increases the receivable. I know that it's not being diminished by massive payments, but it's something, in operating the treasury function, you're very cognizant about what the daily balance is, but you don't really know what the daily outgo is because we pay once a week, and when it comes in, you say, oh, it's $3 million going out this week. And then you look back and say, well, we only got in $2 million in the past week. So that's what happens. And the net result is our cash balances are being squeezed very aggressively.
And what happens if we don't pay them?
They hold back on the sales tax.
The state always contends that they have the right to withhold state aid payments to us if you haven't complied with the regulations.
But they're already doing that.
Martha?
Yeah.
David, this is not a pretty picture, but what's the potential that this could affect our bond rating?
Well, universally, if it's happening all over, it shouldn't have an effect other than the fact that everybody would be treated the same. And they haven't, because until you really have to test the market. Ultimately, if you do cash flow borrowing, it's looked upon basically on two bases. Is this something you could have prevented, or is this something, because the assumption is you're in New York State and you're highly dependent upon state and federal, is it a function of your inability to be repaid on a timely basis versus is it a management situation where you are spending more than you have programmed and you're not controlling things?
Okay. Thank you, David. All right. We could take a little break here. We have only a few resolutions, but we do have committee reports.
We have an executive session.
We have an executive session later as well. I feel a pall over this room at this point. I don't know if a break will help. Want to keep going?
Let's keep going.
Let's keep going. All right. Are there any resolutions to be added to or withdrawn from the agenda? No, then. We have the consent agenda. All right. Okay. I will read them. If there's anything that you want withdrawn, just say so. Award of bid, leachate hauling from closed landfills. Resolution A. Let's see if there are what revised. That's a revised one that's in your packet.
Yep.
Resolution B. Increase in hours mail on records clerk, county clerk. This is from the budget committee this afternoon. Resolution C. Authorization to execute quit claim deeds, sale of foreclosure properties at public auction. Resolution D, authorization to execute quit claim deed properties redeemed before county auction. That's the consent agenda. And appointments are there. Lisa Patz to the Workforce Investment Board. Paul Gardner to the Workforce Investment Board. Also to the Workforce Investment Board, Mark Coldren and Lisa Holmes. Is there a motion for the consent agenda? Kathy moves, Frank seconds. All in favor? Please say aye. Any opposed? Thank you very much. That's done. All right. First report, budget and capital. Jim, Dennis. Do you have a report besides your motions that were done?
No. We're having a meeting Monday. I just noticed on my electronic device that I'm not supposed to be looking at, that the request has been sent out for the agenda items to be added by any department heads, and please do that. And we're having a meeting Monday afternoon at 3:30, I believe. And that concludes my report.
All right, Kathy.
Would it be appropriate for members of the committee to add agenda items?
You know what? I don't want to be the arbiter of appropriateness for adding items to the agenda. You mean for tonight or for Monday?
For Monday's committee meeting.
Yeah. I mean, I think every committee member, unless somebody tells me no, every committee member can add an item to the agenda. Are you
great.
Willing to... I mean, do you want to say what it is now?
Well, sure. It's the revisionist minutes interpretation that I thought would be on the budget committee's agenda and the F&I committee's agenda. And I've heard from Mike Lane that, of course, it would be fine. And as you know, or may not know, I'm unable to attend the F&I committee because it occurs during a time when I'm at work. However, budget committee, which has HR responsibilities, is a committee that I serve on, and I mentioned that I think it's appropriate, and I mentioned at capital review committee that it be brought to that committee for consideration. And I'm formally requesting for the record that be included in the budget committee's discussion because I'd like to see committee in public discuss this for transparency purposes, and I'll be making a comment about that later on.
Well, that's fine with me, Kathy, but all Mike's meetings are public.
And I'd be happy to hear about any discussion that takes place at that committee regarding this topic, as I've requested.
Sure, I'm fine with that.
Okay, Public Safety Committee, Nathan Shinigami, Chair.
Hello, yes. The Public Safety Committee met last Wednesday, that was June 30th, I believe, at 3:30. And Leslin was a great vice chair and helped me start off that meeting and actually then chaired the rest of the meeting. So I don't know if I should be giving the report, though I was there. And the bulk of our time was spent, in addition to Wes McDermott's appointment discussion, the bulk of our time was spent on getting a presentation about the new computer-aided dispatch system. This is a state-of-the-art system which allows our law enforcement individuals to get the latest information so that they can dispatch, so they can get accurate dispatch calls, so that they can immediately survey a site and look for things like possible escape routes. If somebody is, say, in a home, invading a home, there's and many other basic functions that, frankly, I think are pretty standard these days throughout the United States. But what I think set this this presentation apart, and what set Spillman apart, was not only the continuous upgrades that we would be getting with this agreement, but also the fact that there is an incredible management tool that's built into the system that allows us to do trending and tracking of patterns throughout the county, so that we can see if there is a pattern of burglaries that are happening in a certain area, or if certain types of crime are on the rise. That type of information will allow our law enforcement leaders, like the sheriff or like our Chief Lely at the Ithaca Police Department, to have information that will not only solve crimes but also prevent crimes from happening. So it was a great presentation. We approved unanimously for a resolution to be drawn up and a capital request to be submitted. And we haven't scheduled it yet, but we will have a special committee meeting to approve that resolution so we can get this going as soon as possible. But overall, it was a great presentation, and I thank all of the work that all of our law enforcement professionals and county staff did on this incredible project. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nathan. Anyone else? Peter?
It certainly was a great presentation, and it sounded wonderful. As a born skeptic, I've heard other such presentations, one at Cornell for a massive redoing of the whole, all the information systems, which sounded wonderful and was a total disaster. You never really know whether it lives up to the PR that they're giving, but There was something that I heard that concerned me, and I just wanted to bring it up here, is that one gets automatic upgrades without paying for them, but in the end you pay for them. And there's a maintenance fee that was considerable, and I don't remember what fraction of the buy-in price was the maintenance fee.
It was $152,000.
It was $152,000 out of what? Out of
1.3.
Well, yeah. So it's 10%, right? So it's like paying 10% interest. But that's the way it goes. You need upgrades. But the thing that concerned me about it is that the price can and will be expected to go up for the upgrades. And once we buy the system, we're stuck with it. And there was a cap on how much they could increase the price per annum, and they, of course, assured us that there would be no, on the average, it would be nowhere close to that, but it was a very large number, and that we would be signing into, again, I don't remember the number. Was it 7% per annum, which was the cap, or 9%?
Yes,
I don't
remember. The maximum was 7%.
It was 7%. So if we bought this system and if they chose to increase it at 7% per annum, we would have to pay it or toss it away. So it worried me a little bit, and I would have hoped that one could write that language in a way that said it couldn't exceed 7% per annum, but maybe couldn't exceed 3% per annum over a 10-year period or something like that, that would ensure us that we didn't have to pay 7% every year when we signed it. So I that concerned me. I just wanted to report that.
Thank you.
Frank, and then Brian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nathan, several months ago we received the preliminary report from DINA regarding the ATI programs.
I thought you were going to still be talking about CAD, and I think, Brian, are you going to talk about CAD for a minute? Was that your concern?
Yeah, but
if we can finish,
are you going there with that, or?
No.
Oh, okay.
Okay, because I had something to add also. We'll come back to you on the other topic. Okay. Go ahead.
Peter, I too was a skeptic of this whole thing at the beginning, and you know, I let that, I know a little something about that area, so I volunteered to be part of the process, and I'm convinced that the way they're going, the company that they're using, is the right way to go, and that it is necessary. The CAD system that they currently have, in a word, is probably dangerous to the safety of officers and the public out there. It's antiquated. You mentioned maintenance fees. There's maintenance fees with the piece of junk that they have now. You know, that's just the way it is. But I was a skeptic. As Joe knows, and we had several conversations about it, and actually got a lot of the parties together. I applaud that committee, knowing what the some of the original bids were, and in addition to being good IT people and knowing what they're doing, they're also very good negotiators, as it turns out, and got a lot of add-ins and whittled them down quite a lot. I will say also with Spillman, I am hopeful, and you're right, you know, it's to a certain degree, it's a crapshoot, you know, as far as, you know, if they're going to live up to what we think they are in anything. But I know that company really wants to, they seem to be aggressive. They really want to break into this market, and I think they would bend over backwards, and they have been bending over backwards to try to get into this New York State market. And I'm hopeful and somewhat confident that it will work. And we'll be bringing a resolution to the next full legislative meeting. Because I know they want to get going as soon as we can. So
I'd like to thank Brian for serving in that role for the committee. I mean, he was able to bring a lot of expertise, and then as he said, bring a skeptical viewpoint at first, and really look deeply at the system. So thank you.
Yeah, and I would just say this is just the final piece to the communications project, the $20 million project that we've been doing. This has been part of it all along. This is, you know, not. Much of this has been part of that plan all along, really, to finish that up. And Cornell has chosen the same vendor. I guess they're already sort of working with them. So I think, you know, it's something, most of the money is still in the bank, basically, from the original capital project. Sheriff is confident of getting a grant for part of it. And then there's, unfortunately, one piece left, but... David is going to be working on that to manage that. So there's been a lot of work that's gone into that, into this whole project. Okay, thanks for waiting, Frank.
Nope. Okay. No problem. Thanks, Martha. Nathan, several months ago, Dina Bodner presented us with the preliminary report on three programs through ATI. Are we expecting another report from her, or at some point, and if so, when, and do you know which pieces they'll cover?
Yeah, I know it was contingent on a lot of things, funding sources and being able to access that information. Pat Michel was not able to make our last public safety meeting because it was a out-of-schedule, out-of-sync meeting, so we can bring it up at the next committee meeting, but at this point, I do not know exactly where that's at right now, but I can find out.
But you think there's one coming?
Oh, I mean, I know that this, it's something that Pat and Dina had talked about that they wanted to do, and they were set off in that direction.
Okay, thank you.
So I don't think it's been dropped.
Yeah. Well, Nathan, I think she's coming to the July 20th meeting for a presentation to our meeting.
Oh, to our legislature.
Yeah, so maybe if you could be in touch with her.
Okay.
Maybe there's some news there. Carol?
Yeah, sorry, this is back on the CAD topic. Sorry that I was not able to make that presentation. I was out of town. Is there any option to phase? I realize that this is itself a phase of the communications project, but there still is a large piece left for local funding. And did they present any options to be able to phase portions or features of this?
Joe?
Not that I'm aware of, Carol. Yeah. This is really an integrated system that builds from CAD, and then CAD provides information to the records management system, which gets into the cars through the mobile data system. So it really is all woven together. And I don't think there's an opportunity. I'm 99% certain there is not an opportunity to phase.
Yeah. But and also, in addition to that, Carol, I mean, I want to make the point that we are, as part of this package, paying for a considerable amount of training between, I think, 30 and, was it 30 days of on-site actual training from the company itself with law enforcement officers, actually training them on it. Now it's in our best interest to get them trained fully on the full system rather than a phased-in system.
Well, can I just ask that that question be asked before it comes back to us?
Yes.
Thanks.
Anything else for Nathan? All right, Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Leslie McBean Claiborne, Chair.
And I was raising my hand for public safety.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Joe, no, it's all right. Joe saw an answer there. Carol gave me shivers when she talked about phasing. Many of us have been involved with this project for a number of years. And I think, Carol, that question of piecing it has already been asked, and it is of one. It's one big thing. I don't think it's possible to do some of that. The other thing that I want to point out is that, aside from the 30-day on-site, there's an additional, I think it's up to 90 days of training that our law enforcement and emergency management personnel will be going through, plus the purchasing of some of the equipment by the other municipalities to be able to make sure that everything is interoperable and works well. So that might be difficult in terms of phasing. So I know the committee that met, the working group, and has been going through this and working on this for a number of years. Those are some of the questions, because we did look at the cost of what this would look like. So that's some of the things, but I don't think it will hurt to sort of reiterate and get that answer again. WDIC, I have no report.
Okay. Thank you. Health Minister?
I don't have a report, but I want to remind people, if you have not turned in your survey, to please do so.
It's not too late?
I don't think it's too late. I don't remember. I know an email went out, a reminder email. I had to go out last week or just this week, I think. But we really, really need the response has been great. I have to say, but we need as many, many people as we can, but it's been a really good response so far. So thank you for those of you who have done it, and to the others who are still holding on to it, please do take the time to make it happen. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for Leslie? Thank you, Leslie. Frank Proto, Health and Human Services Committee Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Health Committee, next meeting of the Health Committee is the 14th. It's next Wednesday, a week from tomorrow, Bastille Day. I want to remind the board that Nathan has been kind enough to arrange for Dr. Emmett?
Theodore Thiem.
To attend the meeting. It's sort of a follow-up presentation regarding the one he made at the Public Safety Committee. Let me tell you what this meeting is not intended to do. We are not going to be discussing the pluses and minuses of Marcellus Shale and the fracking process. We are going to be I know how disappointed you are, right? Because Nathan's colleague has extensive exposure and background in the effects that in the fallout that brings to a community, he was particularly candid about wanting to tell us about, and I asked Nathan to ask him, what's the effect on the health and human services community? What can we expect on the hospital, on our agencies? Everybody's going to have a dog. What's the effect on the SPCA? You know, I mean, yeah. In all honesty, and I want to make sure nobody comes with a misunderstanding of what this meeting is supposed to flesh out, but it'll be next Wednesday. And I want to thank Nathan for arranging that part of it. That will not be our only agenda item, though. So this is a regular committee meeting. I asked Joe in executive session to give us an update on the public health director's search. And earlier today, there was an all-day session regarding Nancy Zaler's, the position Nancy Zaler is retiring from. I do not have any results of that to report this evening. We'll get an update on that at the appropriate time. Please come to the committee meeting prepared to pick perhaps two dates for not just one, but two meetings. Once we receive those expanded forms, the I keep calling them priority forms is another name for them. Those are the ones Joe reported on earlier tonight are directly affect our departments. But we have a gazillion agencies that are going to submit these too. And I understand that Health and Human Services has a pile that's about 10 inches high of those forms. Or if not, expect 10 inches of them. And the agencies are submitting them too. So we may need a second special meeting to discuss the, or at least review what the impact on the agencies may be. I think I've given you enough bad news. Next Wednesday, see you then. I don't have anything further than that at this point.
Thank you, Frank. And I understand that for your committee in particular, the chair is required to bring the refreshments for all the special meetings. So
nothing is new. Some of us actually brought holiday gifts for some of the staff.
Yes, you did.
Keeping up a tradition, right?
Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Leslie Dooley Kiefert, Chair.
I'm not going yet. Thank you. On consent agenda, there was a leachate hauling contract resolution. And because I had been asked some questions about it, even though you did not repeat the questions on the floor tonight, I thought I would give a little more information about it. The new contract is with We Care Transportation, which is the same group the old contract was with. The new contract costs $47 per 1,000 gallons, $49,000 per 1,000 gallons. The old contract was at $47 per 1,000 gallons. 75% of the leachate comes from Caswell Landfill, 25% comes from Hillview Landfill. And over the last 5 years, the amount of leachate has been declining each year. So that's enough about the resolution that passed on consent. We met on July 2nd, and Commissioner Marks discussed briefly steps that might be taken about the remaining Biggs property. Any sale or possible lease of the land should be done with the town of Ithaca's comprehensive plan in mind and the town of Ithaca's involvement in discussions. He also reported that a capital project for facilities deferred maintenance is being worked on and should be part of our budget process later this fall. And he brought up the fact that with all the recent discussions on right-of-way acquisitions, it might be reasonable to think about having an official highway map for the county. The committee supports his looking into this further, investigating what would be involved, how long it might take. So that should be interesting. We heard from Bob Nicholas of the airport. He returned to the committee with a sketch plan of how the 25 trees that are being lost for expansion of a long-term parking lot might be replaced by tree plantings elsewhere on the airport property. And the committee thought the concept was good. Species aren't yet determined. We had our first requests for 2010 use of certified rollover. That involved Weights and Measures Department and the information about the Public Works Administrator. But there were only three committee members at the committee meeting, and there were therefore not three votes to move those forward. So Jim, I trust Budget Committee will take care of the certified rollover for us.
Yes.
Sally Grubb returned to hear our discussion about public art. We considered a possible resolution to allow the City Art Commission to move forward with inviting artists to use the curved side of our old library and the east side of the of Building C, where the Board of Elections is. Since the tenure of the library is uncertain and the condition of the wall on Building C is not the best, Mike Lane offered additional language that would clarify that any license for artists' use is a temporary license, that the building surfaces would be offered as is, we don't guarantee their condition, and that the county could terminate the lease at any time. The last thing I just mentioned caused some concern to Sally Grubb. She thought it would be counterproductive. She thought it might deter any artist from wanting to participate using these buildings. And so we delayed acting on it. We will discuss it some more, and I hope we act next month. Leslyn may be chairing the meeting then, so she will have fun with this too. Finally, we had a really nice presentation from Solid Waste. Barbara Ekstrom brought two of her staff members who are involved in the ReBusiness Partners project, and over the last 4 years, 225 waste assessments have been done. And this year, the staff decided it was time to recognize the cooperation of some of these businesses by offering four awards, two from the technical side, two from the public side. And I ask that the information about those awards be put in legislators who aren't folders, those who aren't on the committee. She also said that Solid Waste has gotten two grants recently from USDA, $35,000, to introduce the importance of recycling and composting in rural apartment complexes and trailer parks. And since those locations have so far participated at about half the rate of locations in elsewhere in the county. Second grant was from the U.S. EPA, a similar amount, about $35,000, to expand the reuse and rebuy projects in schools, and that will be in conjunction with the Reuse Center. Finally, there will be a new contract with Challenge Industries to bring countywide paper shredding to reality, and that's being helped by a Park Foundation grant to Challenge to acquire the lock boxes needed to keep the materials secure. I would like to offer the opportunity to legislators who are interested in a trip to Ontario County to see FCR's MRF, the Materials Recovery Facility, to just let Karen Fuller know that they'd like to go along on that. It will be eye-opening to see how the sorting lines and beneficiation of all of the materials has changed over the last decade in contrast to what we're able to do in our center. Our next meeting is August 6th. I have one resolution.
Any questions for Dooley? Frank.
Dooley, periodically Barbara Ekstrom puts out a report on what we're getting for our recyclables. Do you have any idea when that's coming up again?
No. I think she tries to update the committee quarterly, so I will ask her. I don't know whether all legislators are interested in that. I know you are, Frank.
The last county highway map that I have is dated 1983, so I'm glad that you're going to update it.
Was that an official map?
It's the highway map of Tompkins County.
But
it's
we have
our county roads on it.
We have maps like that now, but an official highway map goes into much more detail about what land we control for road purposes or might control in the future. If you'd like, Ed Marks might be able to explain it more now.
No. I'll see Ed tomorrow.
Okay.
At another committee meeting. I can ask him then.
Any other questions for Dooley?
Thank you.
Okay, your resolution?
So it gives me great pleasure, Martha, to move the award of bid for County Route 110 Ellis Hollow Road Reconstruction, Town of Dryden.
And that's the revised version?
It's the revised version.
Is there a second? Dave seconds that.
You may be curious about why the dollar amount in the resolution was revised. The amount in the version that came with the agenda was $1.4 million. That was the base bid. The amount that we're going to vote on tonight is the base bid plus an alternate. And that total is $1.6 million. And the alternate is colored shoulders, which will happen on Ellis Hollow Road, a good traffic calming feature.
Yes, I'm very pleased to have that bid come in that way. Bill Sesney had told me that the asphalt prices have sort of taken a drop, $21 a ton, I think, in July, and I'm sure that had a lot to do with this bid.
Yeah, the timing was excellent for Ellis Hollow.
Jim?
What color are the shoulders?
Let's form a committee.
Can't tell you yet.
They're looking at chartreuse. Frank?
Chartreuse. Different sections will be different colors. Dooley, I hate to ask you this question.
Don't.
Okay, are we ready to vote?
All right. Is there any potential? Are we going to get into any eminent domain proceedings on Ellis Hollow Road?
Not that I'm aware of. I think that things are moving along very smoothly.
Thank you.
If I were, we're great at it.
No, actually, thanks to the staffs working very hard on the design. And 2 years ago, it was very contentious. And they responded to the public, and it's going to, I think we'll be very well received, especially with the colored shoulders.
How wide are the shoulders?
5 feet. Any other questions for Dooley? All right, ready to vote? All in favor of the revised resolution, please raise your hand. Any opposed? Thank you. That's unanimous. All right. Capital Plan Review Committee. You're finished, Dooley?
Yes.
No, sir. Okay. Capital Plan Review Committee. We have not met since the last legislature meeting. We will meet on Thursday at 3:30. So that's my report. Government Operations, Mike Lane, Chair.
Well, we met on June 17th. Seems like an awful long time ago, but that's our first chance to report. I'll just mention a couple of the highlights. I thought it was interesting that Marsha Lynch reported to us. Marsha Lynch is our public information officer. That they've been working with, she's been working with the Public Information Advisory Board toward the budgeting process this year. And they're looking at various things that can be done to bring the public more up to speed on the budget. It's going to be a tough budget, as we all know. And the more information, the more transparency there is, the better. One of the things they're talking about, she told us, is having a call-in radio show that maybe members of the public might be able to get information and have a little dialogue. I think that's kind of intriguing. Also, I wanted to mention that one of our members of the committee, Pat Pryor, had a town meeting about budget issues in the town of Lansing. And I think that was a great initiative on her part. I guess it was pretty well attended. And also, it was helped. I believe members of our staff went out and helped on that. Is that right, Pat?
Yes. Joe was there and Marsha both.
I'm sorry?
Both Joe and Marsha were there.
Also, Marsha mentioned that if anybody else wants to do something like that in his or her district, that she'd be willing to work with the legislator to arrange something like that and to work out details. We spent some time talking about what's going to happen when we get the results from census, and that is we're going to have to plan for redistricting as we do every 10 years so that the districts, as population has shifted, will be brought back into equality for the next election. We have some time to do that, and the committee discussed various scenarios. In the past, there's been a committee of the legislature appointed which actually did the redistricting with the assistance of staff and working with interfacing with town and city officials. We're beginning to look at the possibility of having a larger public presence. We talked about, should we have an independent commission? Many of us are out there talking about the idea of the state having an independent commission to redistrict its legislative and congressional districts, and should we be doing the same thing, setting the example at the county level? I think there seemed to be some sentiment toward that. I've had some good feedback from members of the community, including some volunteers already. But I think we have some time to talk about it, but the census data will be coming before we know it in January, February, and we need to get a process together, and the committee will be talking more about that as we go along. The other thing is on the resolution tonight we talked about the reporting of the elected and appointed officials who don't have don't keep standard time for their jobs. To be able to comply with the new requirements for reporting for the state retirement system. And I'm pleased to say that all of our legislators who were interested in that did comply. They kept their hours for a three-month period within 150 days after election. And that's reflected in the resolution tonight, in which we would be establishing for the legislators a six-hour workday. Other appointed officials, such as the election commissioners, the clerk of the legislature, the finance director, and the county attorney and county administrator are based on an eight-hour day. We did have one problem, I thought, had to do with legislator Kiefer, who was ill during the reporting period. I've worked on this legislature with Dooley Kiefer for many years, and I don't think there's any harder worker than she is, and probably spends more time than she does. And yet her hours during this three-month period did not reflect as much as those shown by other legislators. And I'm glad to learn that she's going to have the opportunity later to keep track of her hours again and possibly amend that figure that's in the resolution today. And with that, I'll be glad to take questions, and I'd be glad to move the resolution.
Any questions for Mike? Pat?
It's in a second.
Oh, okay. Well, any questions first? All right, go ahead with the resolution.
Establishing standard workday for elected appointed officials, and I so move.
Moved and seconded by Pat. Thank you. Any questions? Leslie?
I just want to know what it means. Can I really explain what does this mean?
In order to participate, we are considered employees for purposes of state retirement. And we don't punch a clock like some employees. We don't have a standard work day from 8 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock at night, for example. We work various times. We have various meetings. We have travel time. We work weekends. We have different kinds of activities that are part of an elected official's job. We had to show that in order to qualify, we were working at least the standard work hour day of 6 hours over the three-month period. And we did that by keeping track of our time and totaling it up each month. And we then will receive, based on that, 20 days credit each month, which is the equivalent of four work weeks. Did that explain it?
I got that part. I think I should have asked something more direct. So does this mean that henceforth we have to keep track of our time, or this was just the one-time 3 months? I remember seeing the memo, but I'm reading this resolution, and it's beginning to feel like we have to do this again.
Unless you're reelected. You have to do it at the start of the next term.
start of the next, that's probably the explanation I was looking for. So it's not that I have to keep track every day of my 6 hours that I'm working henceforth.
No, right. As much fun as that was.
yes, but that's why I'm asking for to make sure that this is clear.
I will say this is not the first time that the legislature has had to keep track of hours. We've done that in the past. But it's the first time with the new regulations, which is much more specific.
Right.
It has to do with the state really looking carefully at the various people in the system and whether they actually are qualified according to the rules. Mm-hmm. And I think this shows that the legislators here are.
So I think part of it is the title is probably a little deceitful because it said this is what you're doing. You're establishing a standard work day for elected appointed officials, and it sort of felt that like this is what's supposed to happen henceforth.
That's this is what thing. We were told that we had to do.
No. I got that part.
Okay.
I'm just trying to make sure that people understand this, that, or at least I understand that I don't now have to go say now I have to document my 6 hours every day henceforth because that's what the title says.
No.
That's all. Thank you.
Okay, great. Any other questions? I know, it really was fun. I was so glad when we were finished.
Oh, shoot, you don't know.
Okay. All right, ready to vote. All in favor of the resolution, please raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you, Mike. Anything else? Okay. Planning, Development, and Environmental Quality Committee, Pam Magasey, Chair.
The Planning Committee did not meet. It will meet tomorrow at 3:30.
Okay, thank you. And census, any update on the census?
No update on the census.
Okay, thank you. Minutes of the June 15th meeting, do I have a motion on that? Frank moves, Carol seconds. Any discussion? Kathy, Frank Dooley.
Thank you. I'd like to express for the record my deep concern regarding a new interpretation of our policy regarding minutes. This new policy is one I formally questioned on the record at both the Capital Review Committee and the Budget and Capital Committee. At each of those meetings, I requested that in the interest of open government, this new revisionist policy be considered and commented upon by at least two relevant committees, the Government Operations Committee and the Budget HR Committee. The reason I'm requesting review is my strong concern that the practice of legislators, privately or publicly, questioning staff regarding comments that that staff person has made and requesting that the minutes reporting the staff person's comments be changed to accommodate the legislator's request. I believe that that practice is, as some of you are aware, I believe that this new revisionist policy raises legal and ethical issues that must be publicly addressed by the legislature. I am aware that Martha issued a statement on June 25th, but I'm not sure whether her interpretation of this revisionist policy was made public. I am again requesting on the record that the legislature publicly consider and discuss this issue in committee with the results reported at the legislature. When I can be assured that minute revisions do not include the possibility of revisions to staff's comments by legislators, I'll be less concerned about this loss of transparency and open government. Accordingly, unless it's specifically stated that no revisions were made off the record and that staff wasn't privately or publicly approached to revise their comments based on a legislator's memory, notes, or desires, I will be voting no to minutes because of my concern about our loss of transparency in local government and the very real possibility, certainly not intentional or for many of us, of abuse or ethical and legal ramifications due to this revisionist policy.
Frank?
Well, Martha, I wanted to thank you for taking the time to put that memo together that you put together, because I think that for some of us probably clarified some of the procedure. My question would be, do we now go forward with what you sent us? I mean, is that the game plan on minutes?
My intention was, while you know things evolve and the GO committee is tasked to take a look at the 2005 report, and they, there was a lot of tension, and I just wanted to say, while that's going on, let's just here are the things that we will do. This is what our staff, there was a lot of tension in the at the staff level, and I was not okay. So I basically just said, until further notice, if the GO committee looks at the 2005 report, and certainly they can look at my memo and come back and say, okay, well, we want to revise this, we want to state it at some other way, that's entirely up to the committee, and then to be brought to all of us for everybody's consideration. I have every confidence in the committee and Mike to fully discuss all those issues and bring them forward. So I thought, while those weeks go by, because it takes time for those actions to happen, I thought that let's just have an understanding among ourselves, and I tried to lay out the issues related to resolutions as well as the minutes. And I haven't received anything but good comments from all of you folks so far, so I felt
My comment tonight was actually in disagreement with your interpretation.
And this is the first I've heard of it, Kathy, so that's...
I wanted it to be on the record in the public, totally transparent. And I'd like to raise...
Duly noted, and it's Mike's turn. No, I'm sorry, it was Dooley's turn next.
Can I get in line?
No, well, you're in line. Sure. Dooley.
I have two changes to the minutes I want to offer, and then I'd like to make a comment on something Kathy Herrera said this evening. So if you would look at page 4 of the June 15th minutes, that's packet page 14. 3/5 of the way down the page, there is a paragraph reporting comments or questions made about Mr. Ferguson's presentation. Mr. Proto is quoted, and then Ms. Chalk is quoted, but between those two, I had said something which is not in there at all, so I'm asking that the following be inserted. Ms. Kiefer mentioned the desirability of including green spaces and pocket parks in the planning. Mr. Ferguson said that is being looked at.
Okay, so you want that inserted before, in response to Ms. Chalk's comments?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
And on page 16 of the minutes, packet page 26, this was, again, a little over halfway down the page, following a paragraph that says it was moved by Mr. Proto, seconded by Ms. Pryor, to amend the amendment to the title. This was the discussion of the resolution dealing with soil and water conservation districts in the Upper Susquehanna Basin request to them. I made a comment, again, it's not in here, and I would like to see it inserted. It would come right after that paragraph. Ms. Kiefer said she agrees with Mr. Proto that the title needs to be consistent with the language in the resolved. Yeah, so I'd like that.
Okay. So just before a voice vote?
Yes.
Okay. And those are your own comments?
Yes.
Understood? You had another comment?
Yes. Kathy just made me think about staff and staff's words being summarized in our minutes. I don't think there are many staff members who read the legislative minutes. If they did, that would be fine, but I'm not sure it would be a good use of their time. But when a legislator reads the way a staff statement has been characterized, I don't see anything devious about calling to staff's attention the fact that staff is being quoted or characterized in the minutes and asking that staff person if it's accurate. And if that eventuality is what Kathy is objecting to, I hope that maybe Kathy will think about how that could best be handled.
And I don't want to have the debate tonight.
No.
That is what the committee
comment
is for. Okay. Kathy and then Jim.
I have two comments. The first is that I would like for members of this body to consider a hypothetical situation in which a previous chairman of this body made an interpretation of policy as is being made tonight, and actually was made on June 25th, and the response that would have been made. I believe that rather than waiting for actions to be taken, we should assure ourselves at every time that the minutes are recorded and people take exception to the way that staff recorded them by questioning staff, that we consider the effect. And maybe I'm not being totally clear, and I'm going to have to go into this, but it's been my observation that sometimes when minutes are changed, particularly when a legislator takes it upon themselves to clarify what someone else has said, and in the case of staff, it's particularly troublesome because of the authority that we as legislators have over staff, and hence the HR connection, there's possibility for, intentionally or not, a distortion of the record toward the bias of that particular legislator, or even factual error based on the memory or note-taking of the legislator. This is why we have officially trained staff members who take minutes. They're trained to take minutes, and what they do is pretty good. Everybody, I think, on the whole, will agree. There's a problem that occurs, and I know this is going to be discussed, and I hope not just in GO, because the HR and legal, in my opinion, implications could be immense, maybe not for this body, but in the future. Should we accept this as a de facto policy that we have the right as legislators to revise staff's wording? I think that there is a way that the veracity of our recording of these events comes in, is called into question, particularly where there's issues of political, financial, or other impact taking place. I believe that we should be beyond reproach, and not just in terms of our ethics. Remember the phrase that comes up a lot in ethics, and that's that we should avoid the perception of any kind of ethical violation. If we know that it's okay for legislators to call or email or have private conversations with staff in which they ask a staff member, did you say it this way or did you say it another way? Well, there are situations, and I brought up in a previous meeting and in my previous public statement, the Hanshaw Road discussion, where this could be troublesome. I believe this is a complex issue, and for that reason, I would like to be notified if there have been private conversation that occurred off the record between a member of the legislature and a staff in which that member of the legislature asked the staff member to change their wording. I don't believe that this is any more rigorous than it should be, and I'm not attributing any motives to anyone. I just believe that we should avoid the perception of undue influence on the public record.
Jim, this issue was now
referred to the committee, or will be, and I agree with you completely, Kathy, that we should not, the perception of unethical behavior, and the way you do that is not recording all of this and writing it down. We're the highest tech organization in elected bodies. People can see our tapes, they can listen to them. We don't need to write all this down anyway. My sense is there should be a vote shown, and that's all. I don't think we need to be putting out reams of paper with what I might say or not say and all that. And I can tell you from my point of view, I've dealt with the staff completely for 5 years, and in no case have I ever seen the staff feel threatened by any of us being able to say anything. If they had been, I would be open to hearing what they were saying. Kathy, I think it's a discussion that we're going to have, but from my point of view, we're talking about words that shouldn't even be on a piece of paper.
But before I call on Frank, Carol, then Peter, I need to jump in. Kathy, I think, from what I'm hearing, that you've misunderstood the memo. I did specifically respond to your concern about staff about legislators changing or suggesting changes to staff's comments. That's, in fact, in the memo. Those are the things that need to come to the floor, that if Dooley had decided that somebody else was saying something in the comments that she brought tonight.
She reworded what Gary said. She brought up something.
I'm talking.
What Gary said. I'm just disagreeing.
I'm talking.
I hear you. I hear you.
That we will bring comments to staff that need to be changed, or corrections that go beyond what a legislator herself or himself says, that we will be bringing those to the floor, contrary to what had been the previous practice. Previously, a staff would be approached. Did you remember so-and-so said this? They would check the tape. They would certainly, if it wasn't on the tape, if it wasn't recorded, it wouldn't be included. But I take your point. I took your point carefully, that there could be some leaning, and you know, I think our staff has a lot of backbone. I don't think people feel intimidated, but it could happen. So I said this is not going to happen anymore outside of us voting on whatever the comment or the change should be. That was, in fact, the change that I suggested in the memo, pending the committee process that goes through. And if it's something that budget personnel will look at, then that's fine, too. So, in fact, I did take your suggestion. That was precisely the point of that section of the memo.
Frank, I didn't misunderstand, Martha. Carol. I just want to correct you because I didn't misunderstand. I just disagree with your interpretation.
Frank, Carol, and Peter, and Pam.
I just have a point of order.
Yeah.
Why are we talking about this if it's going to go to a committee to be discussed? I don't understand why we're doing this on the floor. Okay.
Madam Chair,
yeah, Frank.
In order, the first, with regard to the two proposed changes that Dooley brought forward, as the mover of the minutes, those sound fine to me. However, in deference to what I'm hearing from Kathy and to the rest of us, I don't know how much trouble it would be, but could staff go back and check whatever the tapes, the notes, the minutes, to make sure that what Dooley has stated, those two changes, are indeed were said that night so that we can include them or not include them. Secondly, I agree with what Pam just said. We're going to have this discussion, or some will have this discussion in GO. Can we move this along and abide by your memo until such time as you suggested earlier?
I would like to propose that we take a vote on and see if there are any other amendments to the minutes. Take a vote on those and sort of pending review by staff according to the recording.
Thanks.
And obviously, if they're not reflected in the recording, then they won't be reflected in the final minutes. Carol, you're next.
Well, pending decisions about how these things will be handled, this isn't something that I would have pointed out. I called Karen today and suggested a change on page 14 of the minutes, packet page 24, that had to do with the report of PDEC. I was expressing the words of Mr. Marks, who had shared information on that. So it's not something that I would have thought worthy of bringing here to take up your time with, but I saw it as just a correction, but I better bring it. Mr. Marks shared information on the public meeting held to discuss the counties, and I asked to change the words area development and strategy to development focus area strategy. It's written on a postcard that was sent out. I hope as the committee considers this, they will distinguish between the kinds of concerns we're talking about here and areas in which a quick phone call, a quick look can correct something. Thank you. And I hope that change met with everybody's approval.
All right, we'll have that in the vote as well. Peter?
I have two questions which may clarify my feelings about this. The first question is, do we keep the voice records forever? That's number one. And number two is for Jonathan. Is there any, there surely is legal significance to the minutes reporting of decisions that we have made, but is there legal significance to the words that were said by any staff member that was not a decision, either the staff member or a legislator, that was not part of the decision that we made or did not make it clear, that it did not illuminate the decision?
I'm not sure exactly what you're asking. I had a long discussion with Kathy about the whole issue, meaning Kathy Cover. And
let me make it clear what I'm just asking.
That would be good.
Every vote we take has significance. If there's a the minutes are the records of the vote that we made. But the colloquy that leads up to that vote, when someone says why they voted for something or why they thought it was a good idea, I would have thought could never have any legal power. I'm just wondering why it makes that much difference. Okay. That's really what
I will say. What the law requires in the minutes is the vote. It does not require the colloquy. Whether that could have legal significance or not is another issue. I mean, if somebody in challenging a vote could point out something somebody said indicating, you know, I don't want to speculate, but indicating that they thought they were voting on the wrong thing or, you know, any number of possibilities. I mean, it rarely comes up, but the law, under the law, what the minutes need to have is the vote. The other part is really the policy of this legislature, and that's and yet changing minutes is yet a different issue, and its legal significance is, you know, in terms of somebody challenging the vote. But I mean, to be honest, in my view, and I'm not sure, I haven't read Martha's memo or anything, but if things are substantive, I think they should come back to the legislature, and if not, I don't think they are, like spelling, things like that. But in my view, any substantive changes should come to the legislature, and I don't think it matters whether they're by you or by staff. That's my opinion.
What about my first question about how long we keep the recordings?
Kathy, do you know?
I think it's permanent.
Permanent, okay.
And there's the
legislature minutes. The committee minutes are not.
No, the videos.
The videos, the committee recordings are not kept permanently.
Wait, the recordings of committee meetings are not kept permanently?
Right. But these legislature meetings are, I believe.
And the legislature is on video online, and you go online and they go back, you know, a number of years, so I suppose it's...
Well, that
not
might
infinite,
help if the minutes of committees are in question. If we kept those recordings for some reasonable time.
Well, do we know how long we keep them? Do you know?
I think you're only required to keep them. I believe it's 6 months.
6 months after approval of the minutes. Okay. I want to point out that it is in all of our interest to have transparent and accurate minutes, to have conversations about them, you know, in open, and to make sure that what is on paper is backed up by the recording. But just in case anybody is watching or listening, to my knowledge, in 9 years on the legislature, I have never heard or sensed or intuited any actual problem as far as the content, misrepresenting anybody's comments or intentions, etc. I think our staff does a tremendous job, and what we're talking about is tweaking about a 1% issue on, you know, details here or there, and I think the public should feel confident that there's actually not a problem here, but the committees will look at this and bring any recommendations for changes back to us. My memo is simply to help us operate in the meantime. So we have three changes suggested to the minutes. Are we ready to vote on the minutes?
Yes.
All in favor as on the amendments? Subject to review by the staff to corroborate with the tape. All in favor of the amendments?
Wait,
please raise your hand.
We're
voting, Carol. All in favor of the amended minutes? Please raise your hand. Opposed? That passes 14 to 1. All right. We need to go into executive session. So, Carol?
Yeah. I would hope that that we do not spend staff time checking a correction like the one that I made. I hope that our...
I'm afraid that's what's being asked. So, all right. All right, we are going to do I have a motion to go into executive session. Moved by Brian, seconded by Pam. After a 5-minute break for real estate negotiations and personnel matters. So, all right, all in favor of executive session, please raise your hand. Opposed? All right, we're in executive session, and we'll come back in 5 minutes. A lot of time for the cameras to shut down. Thank you.